And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. Lots of stuff to get to. Lots of goings on. Lots of stuff, man. And it seems to always get worse. I mean, you know, they talked about, remember 2010? The Republicans took power on the claim that it was going to be all about jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. I remember it like it was yesterday. Laser-like focus. The exact word is going to be like laser-like focus. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Yet all we've seen is divisiveness and division and poison pill and filibuster and, oh, you name it, they've done it. Everything but jobs. And yet here we are some, what, the Bush collapse was in September of 2008. We lost hundreds of thousands of jobs in September, October, November. I think it peaked at 900,000 jobs lost. In January of 2009, losing hundreds of thousands of jobs in February and March, the president's stimulus plan stemmed some of the job loss. As I've said from the beginning, the stimulus nowhere near big enough. But here we are, all these years, all these months later. Remember, September of 2008. Is when the Bush collapse happened. This is how bad it was. Here we are now in April of 2014. And now, only now, we have hit the number of jobs that we had in August of 2008. We're just now back. Now, demographic-wise, we've grown as a country. More people, less jobs. But the job numbers out, if you're wondering what I'm talking about and all the insanity, 192,000 jobs created in the month of March, the 42nd consecutive month of job growth, in my view, still not large enough growth, 192,000 is about keeping up with the bare minimum that we need to be creating. Now, you go back and you look at all of the public sector jobs across this country that were destroyed because of austerity, fetished Republicans. In addition to the, 8.8 million private sector jobs that were lost because of the recession, 8.8 million lost. Then you throw all of those public sector jobs that people like Tom Corbett said, oh, see, we've cut 20,000 teachers and education professionals. Kicked those folks right to the curb and took that money that we would have been paying them, that they would have been spending in our local economy, and gave it to multi-state, multinational corporations to fatten the bottom line. That's about it. So the job numbers out, I guess this is what they're calling semi-solid growth. They do believe that the numbers will tick upwards. Okay, I'm in favor of it, but still, we need a jobs plan. More than anything now, we need an investment plan. We need to be building roads and bridges and high-speed rail and infrastructure to move people around. And oh, by the way, as I've been saying for years, I would like to get out of the third world status of pathetic internet. They keep saying, and I love this argument, oh, the free market, Rick, don't you know the free market will get you the best product? Well, I live in an area where the free market has dictated my choices will be bad and bad. And the choice that I have is, how much do I want to pay for bad? Do I want to pay a lot or a whole lot for bad? Those are my choices, and I live in a pretty decent neighborhood. But I live in a neighborhood where the free market must have missed my house, must have missed the Smith area. Of the 192,000 jobs created in the month of March, half of them were added in the low wage, retail, leisure, hospitality, all the temp jobs. So almost half of all the jobs that were created don't really pay a lot. And are going to be the ones that we end up subsidizing because that's what we do. We subsidize these low-wage employers who have set these models up. In March, the numbers that they came up with, 99,000 men were employed, 93,000 women. And again, you go back to those jobs. Where were they? Well, they were in retail. They were in hospitality. They were cleaning up people's messes. They were in taking care of people in their homes, home health aides, and the such. Manufacturing? Well, not so much. In fact, the number that I saw, we lost 1,000 manufacturing jobs. That's troublesome. Troublesome in the fact that when you have those good, high-paying, quality jobs, and in a lot of cases, union jobs, those, come with me because we know this to be true, those stimulate other jobs because those folks have disposable income and they spend that disposable income where? Locally. Where small businesses locally, where they create jobs. Now, I go back to the reason I bring this up and the reason I think it's so vitally important is we've got a major election coming up in November here in Pennsylvania. We've got a governor who has chosen the right-wing line. He has chosen the supply-side voodoo trickle-down yellow rivers of you-know-what-on-my-head line of we're going to give all this money to these big companies in the hopes and the prayers that they will maybe possibly, under the right circumstances, if the moons align, create some jobs. We know that doesn't work, don't we? We've seen the movie. In fact, we've not only seen the movie, we've seen the sequel. And the sequel to the sequel, and the sequel to the sequel to the sequel. We've seen this. We've been down this road. I know they just keep changing names of it, but look, the reality is here in Pennsylvania, we have gone the conservative route. We have said, here, corporations, we're going to give you our children's future. We're going to pay homage at the altar of the free market with our children's future. We're going to gut $1 billion of education each of the first 2 years of Corbett's administration, and then only $700 million in the third year. We're going to take that $2.7 billion, and we're going to hand it over to corporate America. Because corporate America knows what to do with the money. They'll create jobs. That's what we're told, right? Come with me on this, because I think the argument is important. This is what they say. Tax cuts equals job creation. Yet, no studies have shown that to be anywhere near the realm of accuracy, but it's their blind faith belief. But let's just make the argument because, hey, why not? Our governor's done it. We fired 20,000 teachers and education professionals. He loves to run around the state and says, I cut state government down to the smallest level it's been in 40 million years, and we're smaller than South Carolina, and you know, all of those talking points. And in doing so, created a robust economy because he's the more jobs governor. I remember that, the little Facebook icon, I'm the more jobs governor. And in this case, yes, he is the more jobs governor, more than New Mexico. Because if you look at the growth rate here in the Commonwealth during the governor's tenure, which would have been January 2011 through February 2014 when the numbers are there, Pennsylvania had a 1.78% job growth rate. In fact, the sad reality is the nation as a whole, the average for the entire country, more than 5% job growth rate. That put us behind virtually everybody except, you got it, New Mexico. And in fact, we lagged behind every neighboring state and 31 other states grew by a rate double what we here in Pennsylvania have achieved under this governor. Now, look, understand the priorities that this governor has pursued. The $1 billion cuts to education every year for the first 2 years, $700 million in the third. Letting the drillers get away with not paying. I'm still trying to figure out what this impact thing is. Because it's not really an extraction tax. Okay, they pay you a fee to stick the needle in the ground. They suck everything out, and that's all we get is that little fee? Right. And it's always blown my mind. Is that, you know, go, hey, if we were to have an extraction fee, which every other gas-producing state does, we could have other people paying our taxes. Gee, wouldn't that be a great idea? Now, look, there are things we need to be talking about, and that's why November is so important. You put the money back into public schools. You put the money back into investing in infrastructure and roads and bridges and all the things that we were supposed to do. We go after and we expand Medicaid immediately. That's going to bring in some 40,000 jobs. You want to be the more jobs governor? There's a good spot to do it. Get rid of the $2 billion that we've handed over to corporate America. So you know what? If you didn't create jobs, we're clawing it back. That, to me, just seems rational. But what our Republican friends keep saying is, no, we got to follow the same failed path. Because if we do it enough, maybe it'll work. And definitely don't get unemployment benefits to those long-term unemployed. Make them go out there with a tin can and pencils. Now, last night, you had six Republicans who went against the party leadership and voted to break the filibuster on the long-term unemployment insurance extension that would be retroactive back to just after Christmas. And basically, and what they're saying is that this new report just out by Congress is saying, look, you know, the states, because of them not funding the extension for the folks who have been unemployed longer than 26 weeks, has cost our states some $5 billion in economic activity, which means that was money that was banging around in the local economy, that local entrepreneurs and small businesses, that was funding them. Now, since the end of December, when Congress ran off for Christmas and didn't do their job, right now we're seeing about 2.3 million people who are without that vital lifeline. And every week, that number jumps by 72,000. And eventually, it gets to 4.5 million. And they're saying, if you don't do it, it's going to cost us more jobs, and you're going to cost more unemployment, and it's going to get worse. So the people who told us it's all about the jobs, not so much. Anyway, we've got a packed program tonight. Got to get to it. When we come back, we're going to talk to a UPS driver, a 24-year loyal, dedicated UPS worker who was fired over, you know, from what I'm reading, nonsense. And 250 of his fellow coworkers, his union brothers and sisters, said, you know what, this is wrong. And we're going to take to the streets for him. This is a fantastic story. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Reuben Jones is one of the millions of American workers who make minimum wage. He was nearly overcome with emotion at a press conference in Washington, D.C. Thursday as the Give America a Raise bus tour ended its 11-state journey pushing for an increase in the minimum wage.
For 5 years, I never got a raise. I never had a chance to go out. I got 2 children and 4 grandchildren. I can't even visit him. I can't visit him at all. I don't have the money to do it. I work every day hard. Excuse me. One day, I was coming home from work from Largo. It was raining. Train stopped running at 11:30. I get to the subway at 11 o'clock. Figured that the train was still running. I get to the train station. The train is gone. Don't have no money to get home from Largo, from D.C. to D.C. So I had to walk. And then turned around, had to go back to work the next day, tired. I do everything in that job that I possibly can. For me to work like this, to be treated like this, it's a shame.
Thank you.
Please, the people that hear me now, today, please raise the minimum wage. We all need it. We all need it.
Most jobs in America, roughly 81 million, pay less than $20 an hour, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At least 18 million of those jobs pay less than the $10.10 an hour that Democrats, labor, and progressive organizations say should be the nation's absolute minimum wage. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler.
Working people are on the move. Working people are on the move. And it's women and men, and whether they're union or non-union, they're coming together and they're saying the same thing, that people are working hard, but they're not able to make ends meet. Wages have been stagnant despite productivity going up and despite soaring corporate profits, and that is not fair. So a higher minimum. minimum wage, as well as reform to allow more collective bargaining, right, is critical. People get it. They live it. And they want Congress to do something about it. They want Congress to act and act now. It really cuts to the core of the struggle of millions of workers around this country, and that's why the labor movement is mobilizing. Labor movement is mobilizing in cities and towns across the country with coalitioners because it has been too long since America has stood together to raise wages and claim that American dream again.
The Dream Action Coalition says its escalating activities could form and an end to deportations. Erica Andiola, co-director of the Dream Action Coalition, says families of those deported and in detention will make themselves heard at the White House.
That's why we're here, to say to the president, we are going to stay outside of your house. We're going to stay outside of your door and your window until you stop the deportation of our families.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
To this battle, take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery for these warriors. When you're bound to lose, you fascists are bound to lose.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So a couple of days ago, I've been following this story for some time now. A worker at UPS, a guy who's been there 24 years, spent almost a quarter of a century, or a quarter of a century working for this company, going, I'm going to dedicate my life to making a profit for these people, kicked to the curb. And the outrage... 250 of his brothers and sisters, his co-workers, said, you know what, this is wrong. And they took to the street in a 90-minute walkout to say, you know what, we're going to stand next to our brother who was wrongly fired. And I think that this is the message that I've been saying for the longest time, folks. We have got to be standing together because, you know, go back to the old labor saying, an injury to one is truly an injury to all, which is why we've asked Jairo Reyes to come up, talk with us. He is the 24-year employee who was terminated. Jairo, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome.
Explain this to me. How is it you'll give almost a quarter century of your life to this company, and to the curb they want to throw you?
Yeah, they just turned around and falsely terminated me. It was a wrongful termination. They said that I was punching in and changing my start time to an earlier start, unauthorized.
Is that a fireable offense?
According to them, it was a fire offense because they were trying to say that I was trying to gain monetary gain out of it. That's what they were claiming. But the worst part was that they said it was unauthorized. It's funny, right? Because all of 13 I spent out on disability the entire year, and I just got back to UPS on the 2nd of January.
So that's interesting. So could it be that really what they really wanted to do was just to get rid of you because you were out on disability?
You know what? I never thought I'd stop to think about it, but you never know. Nowadays, how things are going, you don't know what is going on anymore in corporate America.
You know, as someone who spent more than 20 years in the freight industry as a Teamster, I've seen these situations pop up time and time again where guys come back from illness or from injury and, well, you're now broken goods, so to the curb they try and send you. So in response to this firing, and I think this takes me back to the days when I first started in the unions and guys stuck together and it was commonplace. 250 of your fellow workers said, you know what, this is wrong, we're going to the curb. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The guys and girls walked out. Business agent pulled the building and they walked out because it was unfair. It was unjust termination. And you know what, it's funny that we mentioned that right now because UPS, as you might have known, fired 20 on Monday, and right now as we speak, they're firing more guys right now.
So they're just arbitrarily deciding when? They've given termination notices to everyone, and at their convenience, they're going, okay, now you're fired.
Yes, that's what they're doing right now.
That doesn't make any, that makes no sense whatsoever, and legally, I don't know how you can get away with that.
I don't know neither. I personally don't understand how it is. They don't have an arbitrated decision stating that the walkout was unlawful, and the company even filed for arbitration on the walkout, and without even getting a decision of any kind, this is what they're doing right now. You know what it is? It's, they're trying to break the union. They're union busting right now. This is the first step of it.
Yeah, you know, but the other part of this is, look, I give you guys, all 251 of you, the utmost credit, because you don't see this kind of solidarity in the media. You don't see this kind of solidarity often in this day and age, where someone gets fired and you get 250 people to say, you know what, we're going out and we're going to stand with them on the street. And I think UPS is going, whoa, we can't have this. We've got to put a stop to this. And I think this is why this is probably why we're seeing these, what I would say are illegal firings.
Right. That's exactly why we're seeing illegal firings, because, like you said, their comment in the media was that they couldn't jeopardize the service of their customers with their employees walking out. I forgot the word they used, their misconduct. But the funny part is that UPS has been misconducted by violating contract every time they can. They violate our arbitration procedures. They violate every part of the contract. It's just out of control, especially in the last couple of years. UPS has definitely changed. And with the new regime, when I walk back to UPS after a year of being out on disability, you know, I walk into this new management team with a center manager named Willie Rodriguez, who happened to, now I just found out, is an ex-DM that got fired, had to sue the company to get back.
Wow. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have a grievance procedure, right? I mean, you go through a process before they can fire you.
Yes, we have a grievance procedure and a progressive discipline and procedure.
So how is it that they're able to walk around all? I got to imagine that this is going to come back and bite them in the behind.
Well, I'm hoping it does. I definitely hope that it does, because you know what? What's good for the goose is good for the gander, like I've always said. You know what? You do right by others, and others will do right by you. You know, we are the ants of UPS. You know, without us, you know, what is management going to do?
Yeah, I mean, you're the guys who actually make the money. They're just the ones who point the fingers around. But, you know, as I look at this, and to me, the lesson for all of our listeners, and the lesson for people who may not be fortunate enough to have union representation like you guys do, is you've got a fighting chance. There's a process in place here. If you didn't have a union there, you wouldn't have any say. You would have just been gone.
Yes, correct. I would have just been out the door. You know, and it's funny that's what they want. You know, UPS is looking to just get rid of the union. And like I said, this is the first step. They violated contract. They've been constantly violating contract. They, you know, we have a grievance procedure, which they just keep backlogging. My case in grievance probably won't be seen till maybe 18 months from now, because UPS just keeps backlogging them.
Yeah, I've seen that myself as over the years. The companies would do that. And what I find, and this is just, I guess, part of our culture, Hiro, is that these companies now feel emboldened because the culture is such and the job market is such that they think they can get away with it. And this is just another attempt by another huge multinational corporation to inflict its will on the people.
Yes, it is. It's definitely, they want to flex their muscle. They want to inflict as much pain as they can, because it's not 250 families that they're hurting. You know, it's minimum of 1,000, because we all have a wife and at least 2 kids that we take care of. You know, my wife has medical problems. I have a daughter getting ready to go to college. Like I said, I was out for a year with a disability from a shoulder injury that I had to get my shoulder operated. My house was destroyed by Sandy. So I've been going through a very rough couple of years now. And to come back, I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to come back. I'm going to get back into the routine. I'm going to keep my nose down to the grindstone, get back on our feet, and just get through this. And I come back and I talk to this center manager, Willie Rodriguez, and I tell him, we meet on the 6th of January, and I tell him, you know, I'm so-and-so, he's so-and-so, and he says to me, I'm the guy you want to keep having you on your side. And I said, oh, great. By the way, I need to be able to start earlier, because I need to be able to pack the truck out, close the door, get to the mall, because they deliver a mall here in Queens, so I can get one of the 5 loading docks, so I can start my day, you know, early and get done. And he looked over his glasses and he said to me, go ahead and start. Start then. And his exact words were, start then. So from the 6th of January to the day I filed grievances, which is another thing, he brought me in the office and fired me, because I filed a grievance in solidarity for senior guys' start times being violated. And now UPS is telling the media here in New York, the Wall Street Journal, that they had reprimanded me or spoken to me about this already. They never talked to me. We've never been disciplined on any of this.
And that's why you have a process in place, and that's why a steward is supposed to be in place to see this kind of things. And again, as I'm reading through this and I'm seeing this, this just appears to me from the outside looking in as a company that's really trying its darndest to break the solidarity of a local and of the union as well.
Yes, they're trying to break the solidarity of the local, and at the same time, this is definitely hurting the IDT. You know, if this were to fall through and the company get its way, I think the rest of my teams, the brothers across the country in Brown, we have something to duck for. We're in a lot of trouble.
Let me ask you this, you know, going back, because you said, you know, early in January, he said, go ahead and start early. They were paying you this entire time. Their payroll process, if you were not working at the time you were supposed to, I would have to assume would catch this, and at some point there would be written documentation. I got to be honest, this just sounds like it stinks from top to bottom. There's nothing right here.
You're correct, Rick. There's nothing right about it. And the funny thing is, it was okay for me from the 6th of January to the 4th, to the 3rd of February when my shop steward approached me and told me, would I file a grievance because they're violating the senior guy's seniority right to start earlier than junior guys. And I told him, yeah, I'll file in solidarity. And when they brought me in the office, I told him, he said, oh, you filed this grievance that I'm violating. I said, no, I filed the grievance in solidarity that you're violating start times. And I told him, and he goes, well, you've been changing your time. You've been altering your time and starting early. I said, yeah, because you said so. You told me I could. He goes, no, I didn't. And that's when he said those infamous words. He says, we never had that conversation. What do you mean we never had the conversation? But I could prove it in paper that from the day that you and I had our meeting in January to the day I filed the grievance, you were okay with me being able to start early, get in my truck. As soon as I got back into the building, I punched in and started working. I finished filling up my truck, and I left it to the route, to do my route. You had no problem with that, but you have a problem from the day I filed grievance. So on top of you violating my rights as a union activist, you're retaliating against me with a vengeance because I filed a grievance.
And that's the word that popped into my head, retaliating, retribution. This sounds like just a guy who just chafed in the behind, and he's going to take it out on somebody.
Yeah, and you know what's so funny? That the gentleman just took it out on someone. And, you know, and the way he is doing his things and the way it looks, you know, from a gentleman that, from what I've heard, you know, used to be a DM that got demoted, that got fired and had to get a lawyer to sue the company to get back under the grounds of discrimination. What he's doing, this is just dissimilar because, you know what, you're acting because I filed a grievance. Why didn't you offer me the right to rescind my grievance? You know, you could have came up and said, hey, you know what, Hayo, you're wrong. You know, you're starting early, you know, you've been doing it, you know, rescind. And out of it, you know what, you're right. You know, Mr. Rodriguez, you're right. I shouldn't have signed on in solidarity, and I'll rescind. You know, true is true, and if you would have approached me with that, especially when the words that he said is on the 6th of January, I'm the guy you want on your side. Well, what do you mean you're the guy I want on my side? No. If that was what you wanted to do, you should have approached me and spoke to me one-on-one like men do.
Yeah, and that's right there is the key. So let me ask you about the people who have been fired. What's happening with them? What's happening with their families? And what kind of response are you getting from them?
Well, they're just all heartbroken. You know, it's hard on the families, and you know it's a shame that the company did it the way they did it. They fired a group of them on the 31st, so they wouldn't have to cover the following month's medical for the families. You know, it's really incredible what they're doing. The guy did today, like I said, when we started, as of today at 7:30 this evening, UPS went back onto its fire ramping, and just from my son alone, from the area that I work, they had already fired like six guys before we even I started making other phone calls.
Now I understand you guys have had a couple of rallies. You've had some. You're putting some pressure on city officials. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, thank God, Leticia James, who's a public advocate, she joined on real quick to help support the guys, and also the politicians, and even de Blasio has come out to say that he might be able to join on it. State Senator Tony Avello came to the rally that we had on Thursday, and also Michael Giacarno, or I think I just butchered the poor man's name that was there. But you know what? We had a lot of people. President of Joint Council 16 was there, and you know, it pledged his support to us. And also, he happens to be the vice president at large of the IPT here. And like I said, we definitely think that this is the time for everyone to stand up, and this is the time that we need to unite. And labor in America, for a very long time, like you said, the culture that's growing up is afraid to stand up. And I think this is the moment that we all have to stand up across the country now.
And we absolutely here at the Rick Smith Show stand with you and all the, your 250 co-workers who, I got to be honest with you, huge stones. I'm as proud as I can be to, as a former Teamster, that it's my former union that that's leading this. And look, at the end of the day, I wish you nothing but the best, and we will. I would like to have you come back and talk to us as this continues.
Thank you. I would definitely appreciate coming back. Thank you very much, and thank you for everything you've done for working families, of course, wherever they hear you.
Thanks so much, Hiro. I appreciate the time. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
3,000 people screaming out.
Where's our
lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided into their love us all they hate us. Walking billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
Class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about classified photos of Hiroshima and Nagasaki taken by Army photographer Bill Jones. Jones was ordered to photograph the atomic bomb damages there. Though he knew the photos were classified, he made a set for himself. Once home in Indiana, he kept them in a thick album. He later admitted showing them to his immediate family, but except for that, he kept them secret for more than 40 years. Finally, he was informed of their declassification in 1990 and eventually gave his original set to the Smithsonian Institution. It was the only time in history that atomic weapons were used to kill, and Bill Jones from Indiana preserved the pictures of it. In his 80s, Jones was quoted as saying, "It was just an ordinary plane flight for me, but I was absolutely astounded at what I saw." So here's to a real-life Indiana Jones. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Right-wing media have rushed to blame restrictions on the ability of soldiers to carry sidearms on military bases for the mass shooting at Fort Hood on April 2nd. But military veterans and base commanders, including Fort Hood's own commanding officer, have said that calls to expand access to firearms on bases are flawed. On MSNBC's Jansen & Company, military analyst and retired Colonel Jack Jacobs added his voice to those critics.
The situation that existed at Fort Hood the other day, in a circumstance in which everybody has weapons, could very easily result and probably would have resulted in an enormous mass fratricide, and you would have this all the time. Arming everybody in a civilian situation like at Fort Hood would result in a terrible, terrible tragedy larger than this one.
Jacobs, a recipient of the Medal of Honor, explained that it boils down to military commanders weighing the risks and rewards of Army soldiers on bases.
No responsible commander would ever agree to arm all of his soldiers on post. That's all there is to it. And I know I've commanded lots of troops in and out of combat.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, you know, I listened to that interview I had with Hiro, and the enemy, wow, you come back after a year of disability, you come back after battling back from a shoulder injury, and look, I've had my injuries over the years, and I know how difficult it can be to come back and get back into the swing of things, and then for your loyalty, for your almost a quarter of a century to the curb. And over something that, I got to be honest, as he was explaining it, dumber and dumber as it. I guess you got to question who you've got in charge of these things. Anyway, that's why we've asked our good friend, State Representative Pat Harkin, to come talk with us. He's also a former UPS driver. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's great to be with you. I appreciate you having me on.
You know, I look at this, and I just look at our culture, Pat, and it seems that we've got this idea, this mentality of business-friendly, that we've now given these corporations, these huge behemoths, all of this power.
And I lived it. I went through what these guys are going through firsthand. I experienced age discrimination. Some of the guys that taught me their trade, I saw them get bounced around and fired and laid off for 5 days, and then they bring them back. And people are left go, and they're terminated, and they use tough words with them. I think back even to the strike of 97 that I was involved with.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember it vividly. But here's the thing. I mean, UPS has this, the tightest ship in the shipping business, and such a clean-cut, you know, kind of image. And you go, this has got to be, and I'm hoping it turns into, a public relations nightmare because it's idiotic.
And I've spoken to some of their high-up management in Atlanta and told them, we're trying to help them with some things in Pennsylvania. They've got to get this black eye fixed real quick if they want any help from me and some of the people that I work with. But I tell the stories to some of the people that I work with in the House who are long-term House members and senators, and even people with Rendell's office that I'm friends with that were labor people. When they hear the things that we went through, they look at you like you have like you're speaking a foreign language. It's unheard of, and I think I've seen it in cyclical stages where it, they'll have these threatening people, and then they get reined in. And it is going to be a black eye for the company, and they can't afford it after the Christmas debacle with what they had happen.
Yeah.
But I think that as time goes on, they're going to realize corporations aren't viewed very positively right now.
Nor should they be. I mean, with the behavior that we've seen as of late. But, you know, to me, I got to be honest, Pat, to me, the message here is not as horrible UPS as they are. But it's the solidarity of these 250 people who said, you know what, we're not taking this garbage anymore, and we're going to stand by this guy. To me, in this day and age, that is huge.
It's very, very heartwarming to see it and to hear that this guy was off and he came back and he didn't perform to their standards. And I was sitting listening to him, and I thought I was in that boat. I was in that, and it's usually right after Christmas. They use the hell out of you up until Christmas, and then come January, you're nothing to them. Until spring comes, this time of year they start picking up again, and they need you. But I was in that boat, and it's very intimidating. They'll have three or four managers in there, and they'll berate you. And you have a union steward with you, but you feel like you're at their beck and call.
Yeah, and I just thought that was the freight industry, because we used to go every January. The letters were flying like like things like they were shooting them out of a shredder.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember those days not very fondly.
Yeah, I mean, I was a steward for a number of years, and I remember, you know, every January, February, March, you'd get all of this flurry of discipline, and you know, then suspensions and all of this stuff to get people up to, into the progression. And it was more not just to suspend them, not more just a discipline. It was to suspend them so you could cut labor costs.
Cut labor costs, but they also wanted to send a message, and you'd get some zealous manager, young guy, usually right out of school. And he'd want to tell a guy who had 30, 40 years in how to do his job. And they'd always, it would crack me up because they would say they wanted to take me out and teach me people skills.
Yeah.
And this was the guy that would always be the one either getting threatened from the hourlies and everything else for his lack of professionalism. But
people skills. I mean, UPS drivers are the ones who are, you know, they're right up there with nurses and teachers, beloved characters.
So it was a great segue into the State House.
There you go. You're out there shaking hands and kissing babies.
Exactly.
That's where I went wrong. I was doing the freight thing, and we didn't actually deal with people.
It's a great thing. And I don't get me wrong. I love the company. I love the people, and I miss the customers. It was like family. There was 150 people every day that I dealt with that were really genuinely good people. But for those 15 minutes in the morning when you had your TLA, your talk, listen, and act, and the things that they told you they were going to do for you, it was miserable. And they'd tell you, hey, don't put your seatbelt on, so we're not the ones that have to go and be the bad guy. And tell your family member that you're dead and this and that. It was all bullshit.
and that it was. I look at this, and to me, the message is for all working people that we shouldn't be putting up with it, that we should be standing shoulder to shoulder. We should be standing in solidarity. Because, you know, you look across the country, whether it was, you know, 3 years ago when we were in Wisconsin and when we were in Ohio and Michigan and all of these places that we here at the program went to as the assaults on workers' rights and collective bargaining and the right to be a member of a union have been under assault. I've been saying we need to be getting organized so that when the time comes, not just 250 of us, but 2,500 of us, 25,000 of us need to be going out into the streets.
Oh, believe me, they're still trying with that paycheck deduction and everything else. They're today, they're sending emails out again on get contact your house member. I'm encouraging people. These 250, I hope they're all registered to vote. I hope they're involved in the process, and I hope they even consider doing what I did and jump in the political fray. That's the only way you get change, and that's the only way you get working people to have a voice.
And that, to me, that's the big answer. You don't like the people who are in office, get them out, and get people like you. And I look at what happened just down in the 28th Senatorial District here in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
Where Tony Soprano's little brother got elected, the trash man. and you go, wait a second, that's not quite the guy that I want representing me. Because I got to be honest, I don't think he understands what it's like to be someone who has to get up and work for a paycheck every week.
No, and we're not allowed to use our political or our cell phones and things that are state related for campaign purposes. But this guy was emailing people every day on his progress of his campaign, and God love him, he won, and he pulled off a victory that a lot of people couldn't do. But he had a lot of money to spend. But at the end of the day, somebody I knew emailed him and said, "Hey, look, you're a member now. You can't be sending this kind of stuff." And he wrote back to the guy and said, "Hey, look, I pay more taxes than anybody else in this state. I'm allowed to do whatever I want, basically."
There you go.
Yeah.
He's going to be a short timer.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting about him, though, is he made his money where? Off the government.
Exactly. They all, like I said, always said, they all want to use the ladder and then pull it up after themselves.
So, you know, as you look at this, and as you look at this story, and as you look at the assaults that are going on, because all of the nonsense, the paycheck destruction, the wanting to make it illegal for me to, or make it stalking for me to talk to my coworker, you know, all of this stuff, the no rights at work, all of this stuff, at some point, don't we as working people have to, at some level, have a visceral repulsion to what these people are trying to do to us?
Well, they always say that the pendulum swings, and I think it is swinging back in the favor of the working people. It's a slow process, but I do see some headway being made. But it's not until people wake up and things like this happen up in New York, and my heart goes out to those people, but it's not until you have some things like this happen that it wakes people up and they realize, you know, nobody's out there doing you any favors, and especially these corporations.
No, I mean, it leaves me scratching my head as to you know, what this company is thinking. And I got to wonder if this was just something that this guy was, "I'll show you." Because I've seen this happen 100 times where you get a manager who comes in and goes, "Oh, I'll put this guy in his place."
And I think he may be bucking for a higher up or a promotion. And I know when I was there and when I started 30 years ago, it was the big deal that if you came across as a hard ass, they would promote you very quickly. Some sensible people got in the mix and realized that wasn't the way you treat people, and things smoothed out and calmed down after that strike in 97. But as time went on, it sounds like they got more of these kind of people into those positions, and I think they're going to have to weed that out very quickly.
Or maybe it's going to take because as I was looking at this, I'm going, well, you know, they fire all 250 of these people. What happens? What do the Teamsters do company-wide?
Right.
Do you now say, look, you're violating the contract. We're going to have a national strike over this?
And I would like to see it go before an arbitrator. I would like to see the courts get involved and rule on this and take them to task and prove who's right and wrong.
Let me ask you, because you're someone who I'm sure understands the process much better than I do. I was a freight guy. I didn't understand the whole UPS process as well as it was. But there's a process if you want to fire somebody, unless it's for, you know, coming to work drunk or stealing or fighting or punching out a supervisor. For all of this other stuff, there's a process, right?
There is a process, and I mean, I got written up one time and threatened with termination for not carrying the keys on my pinky finger.
Get out of here!
Yeah. I kept the letter. It was hilarious. I actually was going to get a frame to put in my office when I got on the labor committee, but I saved them some grief with that. But no, it's simple pettiness, and there is a process in place, and the steward is there to represent you, and you have to follow the procedure. But nine times out of ten, if it did go any further than your local, it was laughed at, and people would, the court system would say, don't bother us with these kind of things. So that's what I mean. It would be nice to take this to the courts and let them say, hey, you know, grow up and start treating people with respect and decency, work together, and accomplish your goal.
And isn't that the other part of this? I mean, really, what we're seeing in labor management relations right now is management saying, you labor have no rights. We're going to impose. We're going to dictate. We don't have to sit down. We don't have to talk to you. You'll do what we want, and you'll like it.
Exactly. I have a son up at Cornell in their ILR program, and I sent this to him the other night and a few professors. And Matty sent back to me, and he said, is this really a fight UPS wants to get into at this point?
Because I'm looking at this as an opportunity to start organizing people. This is a story of, you know, look, this is one of those moments where you go, they fired the guy for no reason whatsoever. They violated the terms of their own contract, and I'm supposed to ship my stuff with them now? Now I've got stuff I need shipped. Who do? I guess I got to go to the post office.
And go back and look, too, at the breaks that they receive from the big cities. You know, with the governments, they're always looking for help, and I'm always there for them. But things like this really make me scratch my head and say, should I or shouldn't I?
Yeah. Well, you know, I go back to this, and it's just not these workers. It's all workers in our state and in our country that are getting the shaft and the short end of the stick. But, you know, I got to be honest. I see this, and there's hope for me that there are 250 people who said, you know what, we're going to stand with this coworker of ours, and we're gonna go to the streets, and we're gonna stand with. To me, that's enormous.
Yeah, and I hope these people understand the enormous power of the people like the Koch brothers. If these 250 people would take on those two people, word of mouth, registering people to vote, and involvement in the process, I think we could start beating these people back, and that's what we need to do.
Yeah, they may have all the money, and as I always say, we've out-procreated them.
Right, right.
So as long as you don't allow the Republicans to steal my right to the ballot box, I think we might have a shot.
And boy, they tried that this week with the funding of campaigns and everything else. If ever a time we need a different system, this really spoke to it this week.
Now, let me ask you a last line of questioning. Just on Wednesday, the Supreme Court, and I know this is well out of your jurisdiction and maybe out of your thought process, but I doubt it. The Supreme Court made this idea that, hey, you know what, money's speech, and there's no caps, and Koch brothers, and Sheldon primary, and all you wealthy people, go ahead, go at it. Spend as much as you want.
And then they wonder why we have a few people dictating the wealth in the United States and abroad. It's sickening. It's where you really, really need campaign finance reform.
So I look at this, and isn't the answer to this publicly financed elections? And I understand that Senator Dalen Leach is tomorrow or Monday proposing just that.
And that's critical right now. From the top offices on down to local row offices, that would be an essential ingredient to bring back honesty and fairness, I think.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Pat,
I appreciate your input, your thoughts on this. I guarantee you I will be calling you back again as this moves down the road to get some of your insight.
I look forward to it, Rick, and I appreciate you having me on tonight.
Thanks so much. It's always great talking with you. Our good friend, Pennsylvania State Representative Pat Harkins. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Like that little choo-choo in the children's book, Moral Monday is the little movement that says, I think I can, and it just keeps chugging up the hill. this progressive Citizens Action Coalition in North Carolina, became a full-throttle citizens' uprising in the Tar Heel State early last year. Fueled by rising public outrage at the rampant right-wing extremism of the Republican-run state government, a few advocates for workers, civil rights, and other people's issues went inside the state capitol on a Monday in April. Led by Reverend William Barber, head of the state NAACP, they literally put their bodies on the line in protest of the GOP's reckless crusade to turn North Carolina into a ties utopia for unfettered corporate greed and Tea Party wackiness. Several of the small group were arrested that day, and Republicans leaders berated their protest as Moron Monday. But the protesters kept coming, and their numbers kept growing. For Moral Monday had struck a chord, and the protest spread across the state. A rally in February drew more than 80,000 people, and public approval ratings for the governor and state assembly have tanked. The legislature is now out of session, but Moral Monday still has weekly meetings and is launching a 50-county organizing and voter education campaign this summer. It's no longer a protest, but a burgeoning, multi-issue, grassroots movement for progressive change. And it's literally on the move, branching out to other states. Moral Monday, Georgia, is going full steam this year. South Carolina has a Truthful Tuesday movement gaining steam. And the movement is getting started in Alabama, Florida, New York, and Wisconsin. This is Jim Hightower saying, some of these states are mighty steep political hills for progressives to climb, but success begins with someone saying, I think I can. I think I can. To have a movement, you've got to start moving.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website, thericksmithshow.com. Also do the Stitcher. If you've got the smartphone app, put it on your phone, take the program on the go, iTunes, all of that. You can also email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com with any thoughts, questions, comments that may pop up. I got a couple of emails during the break pointing out that this is just like a lot of the stuff that I went through when I worked as a freight, when I worked for Roadway years ago. It was the same kind of stuff. It was the same kind of harassment, the same kind of intimidation. And I had a couple of non-union workers who said, you know what, we go through the same stuff where we're at, only we can't say anything. When the boss says something, when he says jump, we already know how high. And this, to me, the message here, the huge message here, is that when workers stand together, you can accomplish things. And I'm going to tell you right now, I will make the prediction right now. This gets resolved. Those guys get their jobs back. They get back pay. And the guy who did this gets quietly moved to somewhere else. Now, if it's if you remember the Bush administration, he would be given a promotion because they always failed upward. And you know, as I look at this, I'm really taken. You know, when I first started a whole bunch of years ago, back in the late '80s, in the freight industry. I remember the guys used to walk together from the parking lot into the facility. They'd wait 10, 15 minutes for everybody to get there, and they would all walk in together. And at the end of the shift, everyone would walk out together. Over the years, I've seen that break down, that kind of solidarity, that kind of camaraderie, that kind of brotherhood, whatever word you want to use, that kind of, well, community. Because after all, where you work is part of a community. And over the years, I've seen that erode. And it's been eroded not by accident, because you started to see the company start breaking up shifts, having people start all kind of weird hours so that they couldn't. You'd have them, oh, you're going to stay overtime. And this was done by design. Understand what divide and conquer is. The employer class figured it out that if we keep them separated, we keep them pitted against one another, they're not going to organize. And if we keep them scared enough, they're not going to talk to each other. And that, when I see 250 people at the facility there, and I've been past that facility a number of times over in Queens, because I used to go over to the yellow terminal right around the corner. And when you see 250 people saying, you know what, we're going to stand with this one guy, who I got to wonder if all 250 even knew that one guy. Because I worked at Playing Place, you know, there were several hundred people there. You didn't know all of them, but you knew who they were because they were your brother. And to me, that's what being part of the union, really is about. It's about knowing that guy's got my back, I've got his back, and together we're going to do better. Our lives are going to be better because we stand together. To me, that's enormous. And from a company standpoint, they've got to be wetting in their socks. Because when you see, in this day and age, 250 people going, we're going to stand up for that one guy. Because our society, aren't we told, be the individual, be your own man. Don't worry about anybody else, worry about yourself. And everybody, when something happens, all puts their head down there. They're on their treadmill and they keep going forward. Oh, that's his problem, not our problem. 250 people said, it is our problem. Because you know what all 250 of those people, I guarantee, understand? Could be any one of them at any time tomorrow. Could be any one of them at any time the next day. And for me, this is, if you don't carry a union card, if you're not fortunate enough to be a member of a labor union, this is the reason why you should be. This idea that you have rights. This idea that you have say. This idea that the job is yours. And that the only way it's taken from you is with due process and just cause. I think that, to me, that's the message in all of this, that we should be taking it away. Now, I'm hoping that these guys, and as I said, I think this is going to pan out in the next couple of days, especially as you see a lot of pressure being put on this. The company's going to try and save face publicly, but I do think, in having seen this stuff play out over the years, I think they're going to get back. Then where do we go from there? To me, this is that first step. That first step in saying, hey, solidarity. Hey, an injury to one is an injury to all. Hey, we're all in this together. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Reuben Jones is one of the millions of American workers who make minimum wage. He was nearly overcome with emotion at a press conference in Washington, D.C. Thursday as the Give America a Raise bus tour ended its 11-state journey pushing for an increase in the minimum wage.
For 5 years, I never got a raise. I never had a chance to go out. I got 2 children and 4 grandchildren. I can't even visit them. I can't visit them at all. I don't have the money to do it. I work every day hard. Excuse me. One day, I was coming home from work from Largo. It was raining. Train stopped running at 11:30. I get to the subway at 11 o'clock, thinking that the train was still running. I get to the train station, the train is gone. Don't have no money to get home from Largo, from D.C. to D.C., so I had to walk. And then Chinaman had to go back to work the next day, tired. I do everything in that job that I possibly can. For me to work like this, to be treated like this, it's a shame. Thank you. Whew. Please, the people that hear me now, today, please raise the minimum wage. We all need it. We all need it.
Most jobs in America, roughly 81 million, pay less than $20 an hour, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At least 18 million of those jobs pay less than the $10.10 an hour that Democrats, labor, and progressive organizations say should be the nation's absolute minimum wage. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler.
Working people are on the move. Working people are on the move. And it's women and men, and whether they're union or non-union, they're coming together and they're saying the same thing, that people are working hard, but they're not able to make ends meet. Wages have been stagnant despite productivity going up and despite soaring corporate profits. And that is not fair. So a higher minimum wage, as well as reform to allow more collective bargaining, right, is critical. People get it. They live it. And they want Congress to do something about it. They want Congress to act and act now. It really cuts to the core of the struggle of millions of workers around this country. And that's why the labor movement is mobilizing. Labor movement is mobilizing in cities and towns across the country with coalition partners because it has been too long since America has stood together to raise wages and claim that American dream again.
The Dream Action Coalition says it's escalating activities calling for immigration reform and an end to deportations. Erica Andiola, co-director of the Dream Action Coalition, says families of those deported and in detention will make themselves heard at the White House.
That's why we're here, to say to the president, we are going to stay outside of your house. We're going to stay outside of your door, your window, until you stop the deportation of our families.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, please, Mr. Postman, which evidently they're going to put into Mr. Staples Man, which just is idiotic on so many levels. This idea that we're going to privatize the United States Postal Service and put it in a Staples, really? Well, you know, that was the pitch last October, if you remember, when the Postal Service announced that it was going to, in a no-bid contract, in this deal to move postal counters into more than 80 Staples stores across the country. And I asked this question back then. What happens when Staples goes out of business? Could happen, right? What happens when it's bought out by the Chinese? Also could happen. And the problem that I have with it is another bad privatization scheme, much like here on the state level going after the state wine and spirit shops. It's all about destroying good, decent union jobs. Good family-sustaining jobs, which is why I think what the APWU, the Postal Workers Union, is doing is the right thing. On Saturday in Elmwood Park, Illinois, they're going to have a protest out in front of one of the Staples stores, as they've been doing for some time now, which is why we've asked Rich Shelley. He is the campaign coordinator for the Stop Staples campaign. StopStaples.com is the website. Rich, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I look at this, and again, one of these insane privatization schemes that, very transparent, it's all about destroying good, solid jobs. That's, to me, that's all it's about.
And I think that's correct. I think the Postal Service is headed in that direction. The Postmaster General for the last several years has been making decisions that are not in the interest of the American people. Not in the interest of the postal customer, but it is, they are in the interest of Wall Street.
So I look at this, and finally somebody's saying no. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, they've been trying to privatize the wine and spirit shops. It's like this obsession, this fetish that a political party in our country has with taking what is we the people's and handing it over to, well, the Mitt Romneys of the world.
Right, and I think the bottom line is that the 1%, the people with the money in this country, Wall Street, they just want to get their hands on the money. And the United States Postal Service belongs to you, it belongs to me, it belongs to the people of this country. And I think that if we awaken the consciousness of the people of this country, they'll be willing to fight back because it's simply wrong.
So walk me through this scheme. Back in October, they said that they're going to start up with a pilot program, I understand, which could grow to who knows how many, because there are a number of staples across this country. The goal being, I would have to assume, and you're the expert here, let me know, to close my local post office and put it into a Staples.
Well, that's certainly what it looks like to us. Back in October, November, there were 82 mini post offices opened in Staples stores across the country, in San Francisco area, Atlanta, and a couple other places in the U.S. And they intend to expand it to all 1,600 Staples stores. But the interesting fact is many of these stores are within 2 miles of a post office. Some of them are on the same block of a post office. So it's pretty evident that why would they be putting that in a Staples store in the same block with a post office if they didn't intend to eventually eliminate that post office?
You know, I look at this as another one of those. They've created the poison pill by defunding the post office, saddling it with a massive weight around its neck with this health care contribution. Again, 75 years into the future, I understand the Postal Service has to fund retiree health care. So basically they're funding stuff for people not even born yet.
Exactly. It's a manufactured crisis. The law was passed in 2006, and it required the Postal Service to pre-fund retiree health care 75 years in advance. So the Postal Service, out of their revenue stream every year, has to take $5.5 billion and put it towards health care for retirees, future retirees, many of whom, most of whom, haven't even been born yet. It was done for one reason, to create the crisis that could then be used to basically justify the privatization of the Postal Service.
And that's the MO right there. You create the crisis, say, oh, well, we can't afford it anymore. It's a luxury we can no longer afford, and now we've got to sell it off to what I would argue would probably be the lowest bidder. Whatever happened to the free market? I understand this was a no-bid contract. Couldn't Walmart have bid on it? Couldn't Target? Couldn't there have been a bidding war? I mean, if you're going to do it, you've got this asset in a free market economy. Shouldn't there be some competition?
Well, the bottom line is it was a secret deal. It was a no-bid contract. To this day, we don't know all the details. Our union has been provided part of the contract with Staples, with 90% of it is redacted. We don't know what's in there, and we're fighting for that information now.
Wow.
We think that there has to be a reason, and, you know, that they don't want the American people to see what the details of this deal are.
So what happens if Staples goes out of business?
Ben, if people in that neighborhood became dependent for postal services on that particular Staples store, they're out of luck. Staples has just announced back in March with their most recent financials that they intend to close 225 stores this year alone. In fact, we've had continuing protests in the San Francisco Bay Area. There were 29 listed by the Postal Service, 29 postal centers in Staples in that area. And one of them we were going to do a protest at. The organizer went out there to do some reconnaissance to know what the store looked like. It was already out of business.
Because to me, that's a huge problem. I mean, at the end of the day, all of these privatization schemes that end up costing what they say is going to cost us, you know, a dollar may cost us 10, and the taxpayer ends up saddled with the bill. Once we close the post offices and we put them into all of these Staples stores or whatever, when they go out of business, what are we left with? We're left with either no service or a huge bill to start up again. This just seems to me on such a high level to be ridiculous at best and, well, criminal at worst.
Right. Well, the bottom line is the American Postal Workers Union is not opposed to new sources of revenue for the Postal Service. But we do believe is that sworn, uniformed postal employees should be performing those functions, whether it's in Staples or a post office. But the other point is these stores, these post offices in private enterprises can never be a substitute for brick-and-mortar post offices because they're not going to go away. You know, they've been built by the American people, and they should remain there because Staples could be the next Circuit City.
Yeah. So what happens when I go into one of these Staples stores that has a post office, who's the person handling my package then? And have they been vetted?
Well, you have a worker that's being paid minimum wage, whose allegiance is not to the American public, the postal customer, but to a private for-profit store named Staples. They've received 4 hours of training in conducting these postal transactions. A Postal Service employee has 2 weeks of training, both classroom and on the job, and we think it's a great risk to the sanctity and security of the mail. I mean, right now, your letter cannot be opened without a warrant. If it's in the hands of FedEx, UPS, it doesn't have that protection. And when you hand your mail over to a Staples employee in that post office in the Staples, that so-called post office, it's not actually in possession of the U.S. Postal Service. So what people need to understand is, if you're handing it to a Staples employee in Staples, it's not really at the United States Postal Service at that point.
Wow, now that I did not know. That's huge.
It is huge. You know, postal workers are public servants. We take our job seriously. I'm a postal worker. And my job, my mission when I go into work is to make sure people's mail stays secure, it gets to where it's going, and it gets to where it's going in a timely manner. And we're held accountable for that. We took an oath when we were hired by the Postal Service. And I think most postal workers, I would say 99% of postal workers, take their job very seriously, their service to the American public very seriously. And we look at this situation, and we just don't like what we see.
Yeah. You listen to the Rick Smith Show, where Rich Shelley is campaign coordinator for the campaign Stop Staples, stopstaples.com, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Rich Shelley's name. It'll take you right there. Now, I understand, in addition to this this protest on Saturday in Elmwood Park, Illinois, you're planning a national day of action across the country on April 24th, where people, you know, everybody, me, anyone, can come out and participate all around the country, correct?
That's correct. Local APW locals across the country are now organizing these protests across the country. We're supported by the other three postal unions who have recently signed a postal union alliance document. You know, the other postal unions are in full support of what we're doing on April the 24th.
And if they go to
send a message to Staples.
And if they go to APWU.org, they'll be able to find out maybe locally where one of these actions is taking place?
Yes, we will have, eventually we'll have a list of the cities where these protests are going to be taking place.
And we'll make sure we get a link to that at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Rich Shelley's name. It'll take you to where to the sites that we think are important. So last line of questioning I've got for you here, because at the end of the day, this really is just about privatizing and taking away an asset of we the people. Is there any way of A, stopping this, and B, looking at the revenue shortfalls brought forth by the poison pill in 2006 that could turn things around? And because as I understand, you guys are not you're actually making money without this poison pill.
But right. In 2013, the Postal Service minus that $5.5 billion payment towards retiree health care so far in advance made $600 million. And it's just a fallacy that the Postal Service is in a financial crisis. You know, it doesn't have to be that way. And we believe that legislation is what's needed to fix the problem, but we need the people to create the right conditions to get that legislation passed. There needs to be the power of the people behind our demands.
Yeah, and more people, in my view, into the streets, is why I think April 24th is important. Again, go to APWU.org. They'll have information on where the local protests. I know I'm going to look for one in my neighborhood, Rich. Rich, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much. Keep up the fight.
Thank you, too, and we will. Bye.
All righty. The website, again, stopstaples.com if you want to take a look at what they're doing there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Right-wing media have rushed to blame restrictions on the ability of soldiers to carry sidearms on military bases for the mass shooting at Fort Hood on April 2nd. But military veterans and base commanders, including Fort Hood's own commanding officer, have said that calls to expand access to firearms on bases are flawed. On MSNBC's Jansen & Company, military analyst and retired Colonel Jack Jacobs added his voice to those critics.
The situation that existed at Fort Hood the other day, in a circumstance in which everybody has weapons, could very easily result and probably would have resulted in an enormous mass fratricide, and you would have this all the time. Arming everybody in a civilian situation like at Fort Hood would result in a terrible, terrible tragedy larger than this one.
Jacobs, a recipient of the Medal of Honor, explained that it boils down to military commanders weighing the risks and rewards of Army soldiers on bases.
No responsible commander would ever agree to arm all of his soldiers on post. That's all there is to it. And I know I've commanded lots of troops in and out of combat.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Like that little choo-choo in the children's book, Moral Monday is the little movement that says, I think I can. And it just keeps chugging up the hill. This Progressive Citizens Action Coalition in North Carolina became a full-throttle citizens uprising in the Tar Heel State early last year. Fueled by rising public outrage at the rampant right-wing extremism of the Republican-run state government, a few advocates for workers, civil rights, and other people's issues went inside the state capitol on a Monday in April. Led by Reverend William Barber, head of the state NAACP, they literally put their bodies on the line in protest of the GOP's reckless crusade to turn North Carolina into a privatized utopia for unfettered corporate greed and Tea Party wackiness. Several of the small group were arrested that day, and Republican leaders berated their protest as Moron Monday. But the politicos aren't laughing now. The protesters kept coming, and their numbers kept growing. For Moral Monday had struck a chord, and the protest spread across the state. A rally in February drew more than 80,000 people, and public approval ratings for the governor and state assembly have tanked. The legislature is now out of session, but Moral Monday still has weekly meetings and is launching a 50-county organizing and voter education campaign this summer. It's no longer a protest, but a burgeoning, multi-issue, grassroots movement for progressive change. And it's literally on the move, branching out to other states. Moral Monday, Georgia, is going full steam this year. South Carolina has a Truthful Tuesday movement gaining steam. And the movement is getting started in Alabama, Florida, New York, and Wisconsin. This is Jim Hightower saying, some of these states are mighty steep political hills for progressives to climb, but success begins with someone saying, I think I can. I think I can. To have a movement, you've got to start moving. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Yes, news. We've got the news. News from around the country, around the world. Yes, more news than you know what to do with. And I see that the big news on gay marriage front. Looks like Ohio is going to be the latest place where we talk about same-sex marriage. And I'm hoping, as we talked about earlier in the week, that at some point we just go, you know what, I don't care. Stop already. Mind your own business. That's my grandfather always said, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. That always seems to be a pretty good, pretty decent idea. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in the news. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria.
Thank you so much. Yes, a federal judge said Friday that he will order Ohio to recognize out-of-state gay marriages. It's a move that strikes down part of the state's ban on gay marriages, but it does stop short of forcing it to perform same-sex marriages.
Okay, so if the federal government, federal employees or anyone else gets married in another state, they have to. So then what's to stop all of the people from to go to somewhere more sane, not Pennsylvania, but somewhere more sane to get married and then come back?
Well, now you're giving them ideas now.
Well, I mean, it's the first thing I asked. I mean, okay, fine. You're not going to do it in Ohio. We'll take our business of the wedding and the cake and the, you know, whatever outfits you wear and all the people and the. Because I read something the other day that New York, as soon as they legalized same-sex marriage, their tourism business huge uptick. They saw a bunch of economic activity around it. And look, if Ohio and Pennsylvania don't want it, I'm sure New York will be happy to do it.
Absolutely. You know it.
So it's a good thing. And at some point you go, when are we going to get past this, Victoria? When do we just say, I don't care?
I don't think it's going to be all that long, to be perfectly honest with you, because the rulings just keep coming down and coming down and coming down. And at a certain point, I just think it's very ho-hum for the general populace now.
Right.
And so I really do think that the point is coming fairly soon where people are going to say, it's enough already, but I think it's actually going to take a decision of a court. And I think we know which one we're talking about.
So that's the question. I mean, you know, our court system, not a bunch of of fancy pants liberals, you know, dancing around in tutus, driving Volvos and drinking lattes. I mean, this is a very conservative court structure we have in this country.
Yes. Yeah, well, it's going to take the Supreme Court to come out and make the decision that it dodged last year and to say that because the part of the decision that it ignored last year in its various same-sex marriage decisions, and I'm not an expert in this field, but it did not address the issue of a man and a woman marrying. It didn't address that actual issue.
Hmm.
And it's going to have to at some point. There are cases making their way. And once it's addressed that, then it's over.
And I'm looking forward to that because I got to be honest with you, and I've had a number of advocates for same-sex marriage and LGBT rights on it, and I've said, look, it's not my issue. I look at it from a constitutional framework that all of us, you know, have the same rights, equal rights, all of that stuff. I look at it from that, but it's really not my issue, and I'm, to be honest, a little uncomfortable when I talk about it.
And I think many people feel the same way. It's not their issue. They know it's somebody else's issue, and they just like it to go away because they'd like everybody to be able to just live their lives.
There you go. You know, I don't know if I've told you this, but, you know, I took my daughter to go see the first round of the women's NCAA basketball tournament in Toledo. And we were surrounded by all these Notre Dame fans because basically it was a home game for Notre Dame there in Toledo because South Bend's just a little bit down the road. And there were tons of same-sex couples all around us. And, you know, the two in front of us, every time Notre Dame would score, they would kiss each other. And I found it very interesting that, one, it was Notre Dame, so that was very odd, you know, the whole Catholic thing, but that's another argument. But none of the other people seemed to, the heterosexual couple seemed to notice or care.
I guess people just take the attitude that it's not my business.
There you go. And, of course, my daughter didn't even notice. So, to me, that's looking down the road to the future, I have hope. So let's talk about something
I think that's right.
Let's talk about something that is my issue. Moving along. Job numbers out. Good, bad, what do you think?
Well, the predictions were, from all the economists who were being polled, were about 200,000 jobs. The number that came in was 192,000 jobs.
Okay.
So it was a little under. However, I was at the White House press briefing today, and Josh Earnest pointed out that 18 of the last 19 months of jobs numbers have been adjusted upwards later. And, in fact, January and February just have been adjusted upwards. So it's possible that this number will be adjusted upwards. But we should bear in mind that we're coming out of a very bad winter where the numbers have been very bad, and also that the week in March in which the numbers were done was actually a week in which the weather was not good either.
Right. Yeah, because everybody stays home during bad weeks, right? Okay.
Exactly. And also, the number is actually almost exactly in line with the overall monthly average for job gains since the beginning of 2013. So this is a very acceptable number.
Does it keep up with demographics? I mean, are we moving at least? Because I know there's a certain number, and I think it's right around here, where that you're just standing still. If you're not actually adding jobs, you're just keeping up with the demographic shift.
That I don't know the answer to.
Because, you know, I look at this, and I saw the big headline today, and I talked about it earlier. We are now back with the same number of jobs we had before the Bush collapse.
Right.
and we've got more people. Unemployment rate stayed flat, 6.7%, I understand.
That's right.
All right.
Stayed the same.
So
yeah.
It's not, we didn't lose 900,000 jobs in the month like we did in January and February of 2009, so that's a positive. And for those folks who are unemployed, especially the long-term unemployed, any help coming out of the House? I know the Senate passed its hurdle of the filibuster. Any help in the House?
Well, it depends how you look at things. It's going to be voted on in the Senate probably Monday evening, the actual bill. Two things have happened. One is that in the House, Representative Peter King of New York and Representative Frank Lobiondo of New Jersey have written to John Boehner, the Speaker, and his team, asking them to move the Senate proposal or an alternative, saying we want it extended. We respectively request that the House immediately consider this bill or a similar measure to restore unemployment benefits to struggling Americans. And they've got five other members who have signed on with them, mostly from the Northeast, but actually they've also got Joe Heck of Nevada, too. Now, the leadership is saying, well, it's going to be a conversation. We're waiting to see what the Senate actually passes. So they haven't decided what they're going to do. And there's some talk that they might attach some poison pills to it.
Sure.
However, today, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor is giving every indication that the House will not consider a bill to extend emergency unemployment benefits, even if the Senate passes the bill. He was asked directly on the House floor by Minority Whip Steny Hoyer whether Senate action on the bill could prompt the House to act. He didn't explicitly say yes or no, but he said this. He said it doesn't create any jobs, and right now we're in the business of trying to see how we can get people back to work for an America that works for more people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Pull money out of the economy, make sure that there's no demand in the economy so that the job creators, quote-unquote, then would try and service that demand and then hire people to do. That makes no sense. What idiot would think of something like spending money creates jobs? Who would think such a dumb thing? I think just about every mainstream, rational, sane, logical economist born in the last, 100 years.
I don't get it myself. It's very interesting to me.
No, I just, but again, they're the party of jobs, 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 laser-like focus. And here again, another one of those laser moments right between our eyes. Obamacare, any good news on the Obamacare front? A little over 7 million people signed up for the insurance there, a bunch more under the Medicaid?
Insurance, yes. The math gets a bit complicated for me, but the administration said today that an additional 3 million people are now enrolled in Medicaid since Obama launched in October. So that's sort of throughout the period, an additional 3 million people have enrolled in Medicaid. So there was some question as to whether these are people who'd previously been enrolled and had re-enrolled, but they're saying that these are new Medicaid enrollees. So when you mix up the numbers, they say that it all adds up, and I don't know how they work this out, but it works out at 8.3 million newly insured people under Obamacare.
I
know it sounds like 10 to you, but it's not. It's 8.3.
Okay. Well, it's a step in the right direction. I've been saying from the beginning, I'm not happy with it, with everything that's in it. It is a step forward. And as we move forward, like rational, sane adults, the things that pop up, we will fix.
Well, and that's what the administration keeps saying. And then what I think frustrates them is that the fix is that the Republicans suggest are things that they say are not actual fixes. They're repeals.
Yeah.
And replaces.
Well, they have a plan. The Republicans have a very, very simple bumper sticker plan to replace Obamacare with, and it's called Pay or Die.
Oh, is that what it's called?
That's it. It's very simple, and it fits on a bumper stick, Pay or Die. If you don't have the money, screw you, you die. That simple. I also see Senator Gildebrand and Senator McCaskill are moving to increase funding to combat sexual assault on college campuses.
Yeah, they are. Now, as you know, they recently battled over competing bills to change the way the military handled sexually assault cases. But for now, they've actually teamed up to request that more money be spent on enforcing current law and investigate campus sexual assault. So together, I think they're going to be a pretty formidable team. Gillibrand said in a statement, the price of a college education should not include a 1 in 5 chance of being sexually assaulted. She said America's colleges and universities are the best in the world, but it's simply unacceptable that they become havens for rape and sexual assault. They're doing a couple of things. McCaskill is meetings with Justice and Education to talk about how colleges report sexual assault, because this is a big piece of it, because the reporting just doesn't happen
right.
In many cases. They think it's massively underreported, and Gillibrand's looking into writing legislation to help tackle the problem. Also, they're going to Senator Tom Harkin's Appropriations Subcommittee because they're saying that the funding in laws that require colleges to disclose on and off-campus crime has been utterly inadequate, and they're asking for a bump up of money.
Yeah, I mean, it's a step in the right direction, but I think culturally we have an awful lot of work to do just on how things, this past week, Pat sat in for me a couple of nights, and she had talked to a couple of women who had gone through abuse and all of this stuff, and just the guilt that society lays on women and girls who are assaulted, I think it's a huge part of this.
It's a huge part of this, and also if it's college assault, it's like it doesn't count, because if you're at college, you must have been doing something.
You were asking for it.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a friend who used to say, yeah, I was asking for it. I looked at you.
Right. I looked at you. Oh, I walked past you.
Yeah. I was breathing. And then sometimes that's optional.
Yeah.
Finally, Cuban Twitter. We setting up Cuban Twitter. I didn't even know the U.S. government was actually using the actual Twitter to the full capacity.
Oh, yes, they're very active on actual Twitter. Yes,
you know, to the full
are.
Capacity. I mean, they kind of do some things, but, you know, master that, and then make your own, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, I think this is the brainchild of some young kid probably in USAID who thought, oh, I know what I should do. Let's do this. And they got the idea to have this Cuban Twitter whereby they would initially send out tweets about the weather and sports, and then they'd start to lure them in with more subversive stuff. But they didn't just do it in a straightforward way. When you read this Associated Press story that I sent you, they set it up through covert overseas companies, front companies registered in Spain and the Cayman Islands to hide the money trail.
Ah.
They recruited CEOs without telling them they would be working on a U.S. taxpayer-funded project.
And how did it all
like
go?
That.
How did it all go south? As I was reading it, it was basically austerity that brought this screeching to its knees.
Well, two ways. One way was the team found evidence that Cuban officials tried to trace the text messages and break into the system. But also the grant money dried up. Now, which happened first, I don't know.
Yeah. Austerity. Another killer. But I see that Patrick Leahy called the project dumb, dumb, dumb.
Called it dumb, dumb, dumb. And ironically enough, the head of USAID, or at least the person in charge, is testifying before Patrick Leahy's Appropriations Subcommittee in charge of this kind of thing on Tuesday.
Nice. Can't wait.
Yeah.
Color me not surprised, not surprised, not surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Victoria, have a great weekend. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Good evening. The world has never been spoken to quite this way. We've never been warned like this before, all of us, about climate change.
Blunt UN climate report warns the window of opportunity to act on climate change is closing.
Major funding for NOVA is provided by the David H. Koch Fund for Science.
The billionaire Koch brothers are environmental freedom fighters, say the Koch brothers. Texas breaks wind records, that is. Plus,
a much more optimistic study put out by my favorite environmental group, ExxonMobil.
ExxonMobil agrees the risk of climate change is clear, but says, F*** you, world, we're ExxonMobil.
All of those F*** yous and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
The global warming whiners at the UN have just released a report that I predict will raise the urine levels in your pants.
We'll see. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know we got a lot to get to today,
yep.
But before we do, I just want to give a shout-out and a welcome to our newest affiliate partners, The Rick Smith Show. We're happy to have them on board. You can check them out at TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks, Rick. Glad to have the Green News Report on your airwaves.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
What do you have for us today?
Well, on Monday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report detailing the impacts of climate change, not just in coming decades, but impacts that are already hitting across all sectors of human society right now, from water to energy to our food supply, from agriculture and the oceans.
We see impacts from the equators to the poles and from the coast to the mountains. There's no question that we live in a world that's already altered by climate change.
That was the lead author of the new report, Dr. Chris Field. Now, the head of the IPCC, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, warns that unless we swiftly ramp down our greenhouse gas emissions, we risk pushing the climate beyond our ability to adapt as a species.
Nobody on this planet is going to be untouched by the impacts of climate change. If the world doesn't do anything about mitigating the emissions of greenhouse gases, then the very social stability of human systems could be at stake.
Oh, that's all.
Yeah, that's all. However, the IPCC report does offer some hope. While some serious impacts are already baked in and unavoidable, the window of opportunity has not yet closed to cut our emissions. And this is about risk management. We can still take the exit ramp by cutting fossil fuel emissions, and we can avoid the worst impacts.
Kudos to Brian Williams and the NBC Nightly News for giving this report, frankly, the coverage that it deserved right at the top of the network newscast. Contrast that, frankly, to the rest of cable news, and we got almost nothing on this startling new report.
Now, I did see good coverage on MSNBC, but CNN pretty much ignored it almost entirely.
And Fox News?
Nothing.
Nothing. Well, certainly they ridiculed it, yeah.
But here's the kicker. ExxonMobil is banking that we will fail on the same day as the IPCC's sobering climate impact report. ExxonMobil released a report to shareholders acknowledging, quote, the need to adopt policies to address climate change, but concluding that, quote, governments are highly unlikely to adopt policies that cut emissions. And, of course, Exxon will continue to use its oil profits to hire lobbyists who will influence politicians to ensure there's no climate legislation. In other words, Exxon says, yeah, we're going to overheat the planet, and you can't stop us.
As Stephen Colbert described this phenomenon of ExxonMobil taking its profits from dirty energy and taking this green cash to give to Congress to allow them to emit even more pollution.
It's a phenomenon called the greenhouse effects. Also, the green Senate effects.
Yeah, there you go.
Meanwhile, it sounds like an April Fool's Day prank, but it's not. Charles Koch of the infamous billionaire Koch brothers published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week asserting that he and his billionaire brother and their many polluting companies are excellent stewards of the environment, and he's spending his fossil fuel millions to deny climate change because he's really fighting for freedom.
Yes, we know he cares about science because if you watch Nova on PBS, it says Nova is sponsored by the David Koch Science Foundation, described this way.
The David H. Koch Fund for Science, supporting NOVA and promoting public understanding of science.
Ah, yes. When I think of the Koch brothers, I think of supporting public understanding of science.
Finally, on March 27th of this year, the state of Texas generated nearly one-third of its electricity from harnessing the wind. 100% clean energy, and the fuel is free.
In the state of Texas?
Yep, they're the leader in wind energy.
The people who are busy voting for politicians who are against wind energy and solar energy. Oh, don't get me started. For much more on that, check our website instead at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to the Green News Report, at least until the David Koch Foundation for Science starts kicking in. Find us and follow us on the Facebook or the Twitters at Green News Report. From Bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Deep in the heart of Texas, the cowboys cry hi.
Yippee-ya!
Deep in the heart of Texas.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Times like these, you know, I look today in history. And over the summer when we took our labor history tour that took us into Memphis, Tennessee, to the exact site where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated on this very day back in 1968. It's times like these where you think about where'd we come from, where are we going. What should we be doing? And on this day today, a number of groups, National Nurses United, and a number of union and advocacy groups, took to Washington, D.C. to say, hey, you know what? We should be taxing Wall Street. Maybe just a little bit. They used to do it. Why can't we do it? Why can't we do it again? Anyway, here to talk a little bit about that, the Robin Hood tax and the work that they do, I've asked Jennifer Flynn. She's managing director of Health Gap. To come and talk with us. Jennifer, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today, this big event in D.C. to highlight the fact that we haven't been getting Wall Street to pay, well, really anything.
But absolutely. When you and I go to the corner store and we buy a coffee, or when we go and buy a new pair of socks or shoes, we pay a tax. We pay a sales tax, and we pay a sales tax of 8%, 5%, maybe 3% if we're in a certain community where they're trying to stimulate the economy. But actually, Wall Street, when stock traders, high-frequency traders, when they engage in speculative transactions, they pay zero, absolutely no tax.
Well, I mean, if I'm to believe what I'm told, that's because they know what to do with the money and they will spend it properly. That's what I'm told.
Sure, and I guess that's why we have such a strong economy right now, and I'm being facetious. We've had a slow growth out of the recession. We had the recession. We had an incredibly scary economic collapse just a couple of years ago in 2008 that affected the entire world's economy. And one of the reasons why we got into that mess was part of it was because of high-frequency trading and speculative stock transactions. What we know is that we need to, in order to have a strong economy, we need to have less volatility in the market. We need to have more investment we need to invest in the long term. It's better for pensions. It's better for growth of businesses. And speculative trading is does exactly the opposite. It's a way for a small group of people and big businesses, big banks, to make a lot of money in a very short period of time. A couple years ago.
So with this Robin Hood tax, with this small transaction tax, something that we used to call a Tobin tax, would this slow the speculation down any? Is that what we're arguing?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why most Nobel-winning, prize-winning economists actually support the Tobin tax, or the Robin Hood tax, as we call it now. Because it actually does promote growth, it promotes long-term investment, and it stabilizes the economy. I like it And my organization likes it because we now know that we can end the pandemic. This is new science that just came out in 2011. But we just need a little bit more money to get a small number of people onto treatment. And we can't do that unless we have revenue coming in because, you know, social service programs, housing, education, healthcare are always the proposals that are on the chopping block. And that's where we get our money is we cut social services. And so we can't suffer through any more budget cuts. So we're looking at the revenue side. So, you know, a tiny tax of 0.5% on stocks generates $350 billion a year. And I didn't misspeak, and I said billion with a B, $350 billion every year, a tiny tax of 0.5%. And just remember that we said that when we go to the corner store and we buy a coffee, we're paying, you know, 5%, 8%, maybe 3%. I'm talking about 0.5%. That's all we're asking.
Yeah, and that's not an awful lot. And, you know, I look at this, though, and I got to ask the question. You know, this is America. This is the land of the free. We would never stand for such a thing. It's never been something that we've ever done before. Why should we do it now?
We should do it now because, you know, today is a day of reflection. The anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, as you said. And one of the thing that he was fighting for when he died so suddenly was that, was economic inequality. And, you know, right now we have growing inequality. We have a small number of rich people who have most of the money, and we have a vast, vast amount of, you know, the rest of us, the 99%. And, so we need to do something to correct inequality. Inequality and, you know, leads to instability in government, leads to instability in the global economy, as we said before. And so we need to do something, and the Robinhood tax actually could be an answer to stabilizing, you know, to closing that gap and to realizing the dream. And you said before, you know, that there was this event in Washington, D.C. There actually were 22 events around the country.
Wow, that's impressive. And what kind of a response? Explain what happened at these events.
Yeah, so we went and had, you know, people all around the country go and talk to their Congress members to get them to sign on to the Inclusive Prosperity Act, which would create this Robin Hood tax of 0.5%. So, you know, everyday people, nurses, transit workers, students, AIDS activists, healthcare workers, you know, community organizers went and met with Congress members or had rallies in front of their offices and, you know, basically said, you either stand with us or you're proving that you're in the pocket of Wall Street. And we know that, you know, unfortunately, it's increasingly important, I guess, if you want to win and if you want to run for office and win, to be able to recruit big money. But, you know, we still have the power of the people. And so we presented them with signs to sign on to the Inclusive Prosperity Act and let everybody know that they are, in fact, on the side of the 99%.
And to give them cover, this is not something that is not in our past. I mean, the reason I had asked the question of and threw it out there in a very sarcastic manner that something we've never done in this country, that's not true. We have. From 1914 through 1966, we had a transaction tax much like the one that's being proposed. And you go back and you wonder, how did we build an interstate highway system? How did we educate all of our children? How did we invest in a race to the moon? How did we do all that stuff while we had revenue coming in?
That's exactly right. And, you know, people say, well, why did we get rid of it? And we actually got rid of it because there was unprecedented growth in the financial services industry. Wall Street got more and more and more powerful. And when they got more and more and more powerful, they hired more and more lobbyists to actually get rid of it. So, it, you know, one of the arguments against it is that this will actually hurt the economy and will hurt investment and will hurt Wall Street. And we have the proof right here in our own country that, you know, they had decades of unprecedented growth when they had a financial transaction tax. In Europe, 11 countries and some of the most powerful, strongest economies in the world, like Germany and France, have agreed to implement a Robin Hood tax. And so soon, sometime in the summer, U.S. financial institutions are actually going to be paying a financial transaction tax. And that revenue that they generate, that enormous revenue that they generate, are going to go to the priorities that are set by Germany and France and the countries that have the guts to implement a financial transaction tax.
Nice. It's just like our idiotic governor here in Pennsylvania. Every other state in the country just about has a severance tax, an extraction tax on the gas that's being drilled out from under our feet that we pay. I have someone who lives in Alaska, a relative, who they get their oil check and thank us for paying their taxes for them and giving them a check in the process. So I guess we're going to be doing just that on a global scale. We'll be paying everybody else's taxes, and we won't be benefiting from any of it.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's just a missed opportunity. And I think that this is an idea that whose time has come, once again, has come back. You know, there's 42 countries around the world that have a financial transaction tax. So we know that they work. It's a great way to get revenue. It brings in an enormous amount of revenue.
How much?
To end AIDS. $350 billion per year to end AIDS in 30 years. Economists say that we need about a $6 billion increase each year. And actually, that's kind of pipe dream money. That's like, you know, if we get $6 billion every single year of an increase, then we could end AIDS in like 15 years. Can you just imagine that? If we could, you know, if AIDS could go by the way of smallpox.
Yeah.
And that's really incredible, and we could do that. And you think, and just do the math of how much money we have left over each year for other things like, you know, ending homelessness, ending mass homelessness.
And maybe funding education and all the other things that we seem to not be doing right now because we are beholden to Wall Street. And, you know, this just seems to be common sense. It seems to be logical. I mean, if I got to pay tax on everything that I buy, a very small tax on these super traders at the minimum should be what we look at, because you see these high speed traders, these aren't even actually people. These are super computers that are making millions of trades per second. To me, it just seems like one, we could slow the speculation down and maybe cut down on the bloated nature of Wall Street, but also fund things like your organization. And I do want to ask about Health Gap, Jennifer. What is it? What work do you guys do?
Yeah, so we're an international AIDS advocacy organization, and we simply fight to make sure that people in the poorest parts of the world have access to life-saving HIV medications. Unfortunately, they don't have the same access that we have here in the United States because the pharmaceutical industry insists upon keeping prices high. And the only reason why they insist upon keeping prices high and protecting their patents is because they're afraid that we'll find out that that our lives could be saved for, you know, a dramatic fraction of the cost that we pay. So the average person in the United States pays about $30,000 per patient per year. And in some developing countries, they're able to get it down to under $100 per patient per year. So
wow.
Enormous markup. And so... So unfortunately, you know, we have to also make sure that there's revenue to pay the prices that the pharmaceutical industry demands. So that's one reason why we need the Robinson tax. But if we could get rid of the patents that the pharmaceutical industry insists upon putting on the drugs that they don't even usually develop, then, you know, we're going to have to keep paying. So, but there's a tremendous hope at the end of, you know, this is a great, we didn't know this before 2011, but we actually can end the AIDS pandemic within 30 years.
Wow.
And now is the time for it. It is.
That's amazing. I often ask the question, you go back to polio. You know, my grandparents would tell me about, you know, people who, you know, they suffered from polio, and it was this killer that, you know, they were just scared to death of. And this guy, this Jonas Salk guy, figures out how to, with a vaccine to stop it. And you go, did he make billions of dollars? Did he make hundreds of billions of dollars? And the answer is no.
Nope. He lived comfortably. He lived a, you know, middle-class life, and he, you know, gave away. He knew that it was the right thing to do, that he had to say, you know, and he saved the world. My father had polio, and it was exactly like you said. You know, there was predictions that, you know, entire communities would be wiped out from polio, and so...
Now, I mean, what does that say about us as a society, though? I mean, you know, when I look at it, what does it say about us?
Well, you know, I think that this is a perfect example of, like, we can actually end the AIDS pandemic in the next 30 years. We just need a little bit of money. And here's this proposal that's out there that has legitimacy, you know, checks back the prizes. So award-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, James Tobin, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, the Pope Emeritus, Bill Gates, certainly not, you know, a way out there liberal, but somebody who actually really is a capitalist, and Bill Gates, they all support a Robin Hood tax. This is an idea whose time has come, and, you know, the proposals on the table, Congress member Keith Ellison has introduced legislation, and, you know, it's just, it's ours for the taking. The money's there. It's not going to go away. It's, you know, we're just talking about moving money from the private sector into the public sector. This money, we're not talking about printing up money. This money is there, and right now it is just pure profit for big banks.
So last question I've got for you then. What do we do? I understand Keith Ellison's bill, the Inclusive Prosperity Act, would do some of this stuff. What do we do? We missed the big events today. What's the marching order tomorrow?
Yeah, it's not too late. So everybody should go to www.robinhoodtax.org, and there's a sign up for to become a volunteer and to get on our mailing list and to find out what to do. We're going to have more actions targeting Congress members in next month, and people can certainly go do that on their own. You know, call up your Congress member and set up a meeting and ask them to sign on to H.R. 1579. The Inclusive Prosperity Act.
And we will make sure we get a link at therichsmithshow.com to Robin Hood, the Robin Hood tax, robinhoodtax.org. Jennifer, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us, and keep up the fight.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
I look forward to having you back again real soon. You know, as I look at this, and, you know, it's one of those things that you kind of just have to ask the question, at what point do we just go, it makes sense? Realistically speaking, you're talking about 0.5%. Now, I've often said we should make it 1%. To me, the goal is to stop the speculation. Bring investing back to Wall Street, because you're not really investing anything. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, my grandparents' generation used to get, when they would buy stock, they'd get a little certificate, a little piece of paper, a little bond, a little bearer thing, and here, oh, I own stock in this company, and they would put it in their drawer, and it would sit in the stock drawer for eons. And, you know, someone would find it, go, oh, I wonder what this is worth, and they would go back to the company, oh, here, this is worth a lot. We don't seem to do that anymore. We're not actually investing in companies. We're spending some money because we want to make money, and we want to make it now. And, you know, I look at it and I go, maybe we should be thinking about how we bring risk and investing back instead of let's see who can make the most money off the fastest computer and the most inside information. That just seems logical, doesn't it? And I've often said a 1% tax, say 1% or even more. And if you hold it 6 months, it cuts in half. You hold it for 5 years, nothing. So if you're actually investing, I don't want to hurt the actual investor. I want to hurt the... I'll say it. I'd like to hurt the gambler. Look, if you're going to gamble and you're going to speculate, you're going to pump up the market to where we lose, you're going to have to cover some of the costs. To me, that's part of this. It's covering the cost for the damage that Wall Street does. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therichsmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. All that stuff, you can email me, rick@therichsmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Reuben Jones is one of the millions of American workers who make minimum wage. He was nearly overcome with emotion at a press conference in Washington, D.C. Thursday as the Give America a Raise bus tour ended its 11-state journey pushing for an increase in the minimum wage.
For 5 years, I never got a raise. I never had a chance to go out. I got 2 children and 4 grandchildren. I can't even visit them. I can't visit them at all. I don't have the money to do it. I work every day hard. Excuse me. One day, I was coming home from work from Largo. It was raining. Train stopped running at 11:30. I get to the subway at 11 o'clock, thinking that the train was still running. I get to the train station, the train is gone. Don't have no money to get home from Largo, from D.C. to D.C., so I had to walk. And then turn around, I had to go back to work the next day, tired. I do everything in that job that I possibly can. For me to work like this, to be treated like this, it's a shame.
Thank you.
Please, the people that hear me now, today, please raise the minimum wage. We all need it. We all need it.
Most jobs in America, roughly 81 million, pay less than $20 an hour, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At least 18 million of those jobs pay less than the $10.10 an hour that Democrats, labor, and progressive organizations say should be the nation's absolute minimum wage. AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Liz Shuler.
Working people are on the move. Working people are on the move. And it's women and men, and whether they're union or non-union, they're coming together and they're saying the same thing, that people are working hard, but they're not able to make ends meet. Wages have been stagnant despite productivity going up and despite soaring corporate profits. And that is not fair. So a higher minimum wage, as well as reform to allow more collective bargaining, right, is critical. People get it. They live it. And they want Congress to do something about it. They want Congress to act and act now. It really cuts to the core of the struggle of millions of workers around this country. And that's why the labor movement is mobilizing. Labor movement is mobilizing in cities and towns across the country with coalition partners because it has been too long since America has stood together to raise wages and claim that American dream again.
The Dream Action Coalition says it's escalating activities calling for immigration reform and an end to deportations. Erica Andiola, co-director of the Dream Action Coalition, says families of those deported and in detention will make themselves heard at the White House.
That's why we're here, to say to the president, we are going to stay outside of your house. We're going to stay outside of your door, your window, until you stop the deportation of our families.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can get the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go, iTunes, all of that stuff. Tune in. You know, it's all there. Check it out at the website, thericksmithshow.com. So earlier in the program, we talked about what's going on in Queens, New York with the Teamsters there. And to me, a huge, enormous story. The fact that 250 workers said, you know what, we're going to stand in solidarity, shoulder to shoulder, with this one guy who was fired for, in my view, unjust cause. To me, that's a huge story. And then you see on the West Coast, where the Teamsters are organizing these U.S. food workers, who, as I'm looking at this, and this is, to me, I haven't gotten it all yet, but I will. It looks like that this U.S. Foods is going to be bought out by Sysco, and there's a whole bunch of back and forth, which is why we've asked Ian Gold. He's the director of strategic research and campaigns with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, good evening, Rick. No problem.
You know, I'm looking at this situation at U.S. Foods, and great, more people organizing. I'm all in favor of it. I think we should be doing more of it. But what's going on? What's going on?
Well, what you have here is, you know, anytime there's a corporate transaction, and what you have is Sysco, which is a $44 billion company with about 40,000 employees, buying U.S. Foods, which is a $22 billion company and about 22,000 employees. So whenever you have a transaction like that, it creates a lot of uncertainty among the workforce because, as you well know, most of the time transactions like this occur, it's not for the benefit of the workforce, the rank and file, the frontline workers. And so there's a great deal of uncertainty among workforces. And these are the only two companies in this institutional food distribution industry that have a national footprint. And so there's a lot of overlapping territories. And so it just creates a lot of uncertainty among its workforce about what's going to happen, who's going to work out of what facility. So you can imagine that there's, you know, a lot of angst among, you know, those frontline workers.
Yeah, chaos.
Yes. And so what we've seen is just a complete uptick in workers reaching out, trying to understand how they can better protect themselves in a situation like this. And in the case in Southern California, where they see lots of their, you know, fellow coworkers out of different facilities that are union, you know, they want to, they've, you know, reached out to a Teamster local union and said, we want to form a union. You know, so that's what's sort of driving. We're seeing this around the country, and we'd expect to see more of this as this, you know, the merger unfolds.
Yeah, I look at this, and here we are. What is it? It's 6 years now since the Bush collapse in 2008, almost 6 years. We're just now back to the job numbers that we were before the collapse. We've seen almost a lost decade, wages actually going backwards, conditions getting backwards, every working person being squeezed and squeezed. At some point, and I think we're at that tipping point now where people have just said, you know what, there's only so much of you-know-what I'm willing to eat. Now's the time to be sticking together and fighting back. And I think this is just one more of those examples.
No, I absolutely agree with that. That's, you know, again, you know, when workers are faced with uncertainty, they look to institutions and avenues to help say, what can I do to protect my position? And, you know, forming a union is absolutely one way to do that.
So now this U.S. Foods, as I understand it, not the most labor friendly, not the most worker friendly company, from some of the reports I've seen.
Yeah, and that's why you saw the statement you saw. It's there's a history here, and you know, just to I think give a really concrete example in Phoenix, Arizona, their workers at a U.S. Foods facility in Phoenix tried to form a union in 2008. The company committed over 200 unfair labor practices, and the National Labor Relations Board, the federal agency that oversees labor law, actually found that the violations were so egregious that they gave a bargaining order. So in labor law terms, this is equivalent to say, you violated the law so bad, you now need to sit down with these workers and negotiate a contract.
Wow, that's huge. Because that's rare, isn't it?
That's extremely rare. And subsequent to that, they also had an election in Twinsburg, Ohio, that they were forced to rerun an election because the labor law, they had broken the law so egregiously.
And are we seeing this in California as well?
To date, not as egregious, and that's, you know, so that's the demand for a fair process, because we know what they're likely to do, and their history is that, and here you've got an area where they've got many unionized facilities around them, and so, you know, why would the company, they obviously have a relationship and deal with the union, within that geographic area. And so there's no reason for them to run that type of scorched earth campaign, especially at a time when they're, you know, trying to merge these two businesses. They need to be more worried about retaining their customer base, ensuring that they're going to continue the service that the customers expect. And, you know, that's part of what we're trying to convey to them. We've actually reached out, you know, soon after the merger was announced, we encouraged the dialogue with both Sysco and U.S. Food to say, look, what's most at stake here is your customer base losing faith that they've got some alternatives.
Right.
And you need to demonstrate that you can continue to service and you're going to service them competitively. And why not engage in a partnership with your frontline workers? And these, look, the drivers and the folks that, in the warehouses that pack the trucks, that they are the front line. Those drivers are the front line contact with the customers.
Do you think that, you know, because I see this all the time. Do you think that corporate America has forgotten that or just doesn't care to remember that the people who are actually the face of their company, the people who make the profit for their company and do the business are actually those lowly workers who are packing the trucks, who are delivering? Because, look, I know people who work for Cisco and I know people who work for U.S. Foods. Those are two tough jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. They're extremely tough. Body, you know, hauling heavy goods in and out of different restaurant facilities, going around the back, going down steps, going up steps. I mean, it's a wear and tear on someone's body. But, you know, I like to think of myself as an optimist, and I hope that they've forgotten and just don't, and it's not that they don't care, but, you know, I increasingly think that they just don't care. They don't think they need those workers to do their job. You got people at the top. Look, most of these transactions benefit the people at the top.
Yes.
Not the workforce.
Not the customers either. I mean, because
right.
You brought up about the customers. And a minute ago you said there are two companies that have national footprints, and here they are. So aren't you really kind of creating a monopoly?
Well, you know, interesting you point that out. This is actually, you know, in front of the antitrust authorities, and this one falls in front of the Federal Trade Commission, who's asked for, you know, a second round of information. You know, they can require companies to provide information. And there's state attorneys general that will be looking at this and are looking at it. And so you would think that, you know, at some point these companies would say, look, it makes sense. Let's engage our workforce. Let's talk through all the issues with our stakeholders and try to, you know, convince folks that this is actually good for business. It's good for its workforce. It's good for its customers. But, you know, right now it's radio silence on that front. I think they think they can get it done because that's what happens in corporate America these days. You know, mergers go unchallenged, and, you know, workers end up taking what the companies give them. But I think this could be a different story.
I hope so, because, you know, the reality is, and at least in my experience, and maybe you'll agree, that in this day and age, very few people organize over wages. It's always about respect. It's always about working conditions and job security. It's rarely about wages.
Absolutely. And, you know, what we like to talk about and what we hear is that workers in almost every company have issues. How do they deal with those issues? And as you said, people understand, you know, it's tough to demand wages. They just want a decent wage. They want to have some form of health insurance. They would like some retirement security. But it's how you're treated on the job. And these difficult jobs, it's few and far between where you see a company sort of embracing their workforce and saying, this is, you know, we want to make you part of how our business succeeds.
Yeah, and I would have to think that the company that does do that is the one that does succeed.
I wish more people and more companies had that that point of view. But, that's what we're going to keep trying. We're going to keep pushing that envelope, keep encouraging a dialogue. And, you know, we'll see as more and more facilities and workers see that the union is a way to address those job insecurities and, you know, respect on the job.
And the job security, and I point to what's going on in New York right now, with the UPS drivers, and to me, a huge moment of solidarity, and I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on it, but to me, it's just a huge moment where you see 250 coworkers going, you know what, we're going to stand with this one person, and I'm hoping this is that watershed moment where people go, you know what, we are all in this together, and an injury to that one guy is an injury to all of us.
Yeah, so just for example, at both Cisco and U.S. Foods, so we've got we represent, you know, about 11,000 or slightly more than that, same proportion at each company. And if our workforces see if this company is going forward, if they see standing together, showing a united front, I think we can actually get. We can change management's behavior and really encourage that type of, respect that they deserve.
There you go. Last question. What can we do to help? What can I do? What can our listeners do?
So I think, you know, right now you'll see, you know, to me it's always the case when you talk about a subject, you will go out the next day, you will see U.S. Foods trucks on the street, you'll see Sysco truck drivers on the street, and I think you say, you know, thank you for the work you do, stand together, we understand that there's issues, and for folks that have, you know, some political sway, there's, you know, their state attorneys general are looking at this closely. We want to make sure that anything that goes on, you know, that workers are treated fairly as this transaction moves forward.
All righty. Ian Gold, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good information. Thanks for your input.
Anytime, Rick. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. Right-wing media have rushed to blame restrictions on the ability of soldiers to carry sidearms on military bases for the mass shooting at Fort Hood on April 2nd. But military veterans and base commanders, including Fort Hood's own commanding officer, have said that calls to expand access to firearms on bases are flawed. On MSNBC's Jansen & Company, military analyst and retired Colonel Jack Jacobs added his voice to those critics.
The situation that existed at Fort Hood the other day, in a circumstance in which everybody has weapons, could very easily result and probably would have resulted in an enormous mass fratricide, and you would have this all the time. Arming everybody in a civilian situation like at Fort Hood would result in a terrible, terrible tragedy larger than this one.
Jacobs, a recipient of the Medal of Honor, explained that it boils down to military commanders weighing the risks and rewards of Army soldiers on bases.
No responsible commander would ever agree to arm all of his soldiers on post. That's all there is to it. And I know I've commanded lots of troops in and out of combat.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about classified photos of Hiroshima and Nagasaki taken by Army photographer Bill Jones. Jones was ordered to photograph the atomic bomb damages there. Though he knew the photos were classified, he made a set for himself. Once home in Indiana, he kept them in a thick album. He later admitted showing them to his immediate family, but except for that, he kept them secret for more than 40 years. Finally, he was informed of their declassification in 1990 and eventually gave his original set to the Smithsonian Institution. It was the only time in history that atomic weapons were used to kill, and Bill Jones from Indiana preserved the pictures of it. In his 80s, Jones was quoted as saying, "It was just an ordinary plane flight for me, but I was absolutely astounded at what I saw." So here's to a real-life Indiana Jones. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Yep, business as usual. Yep, more mergers, more acquisitions, more hostile takeovers. And you know who loses in all that? You know, I think as Ian Gold pointed out, it's the workers. It's always the workers. These things come together because one of my least favorite words, synergy. Redundancy. We can end redundancy. You know, those people, get rid of them. Get rid of those people. And, you know, I'm of the mindset, you know, okay, fine, now you've got the number one food industry service company in the industry, number one and number two, and there are only two. Now there will be one. Exactly where's the competition? I know, there'll be small local ones nipping at their heels. Not so much. And that's the thing that gets me. I mean, this false competition, it's not there, folks. Not there. And I just sit here and I marvel at how well corporate America has trained us from the first day of work, that we're always on the lookout for cost savings for them. Now look, I'm all in favor of you know, fair days work, fair days pay. You go in there, you do the best you can, and look, I'm not arguing against that. But this idea that you're going to somehow save them tons of money and it's not going to benefit you seems ridiculous. And I think they've gotten away with it for too long. This view that, because think about what, you know what's going to happen, because we've seen it in other places, in other industries. You have these two behemoths who merge, and they become one behemoth. But instead of having 40,000 employees, let's say, they end up with 30,000. And those 30,000 are worked that much harder. Because now you start talking about, oh, we need to squeeze every second out of these people. And one of the things I forgot to ask Jairo Reyes in the first hour, you know, when you walk by a UPS truck and you hear that clicking, just like that, what is that noise? What that noise is, it's a timer to find out how long your butt's out of the seat. I mean, because now you're starting to micromanage seconds. And eventually, with all of the computerization, you know, they're doing it to housekeepers now. They're doing it to people who clean hotel rooms. They're giving them smartphones that are yelling orders at them all day long. Hey, clean this! Hey, clean that! What are you doing? You know, I just had lunch again the other day. We went to another one of these chain places, which, you know, I keep saying I've got to swear them off at this point. No more Red Robin, no more Chili's, no more any of these. Simply because now they're forcing this stupid screen thing on me, where I've got to order and pay my bill and do everything on this stupid screen. And I'm going, no, I protest against this. I will not succumb. Not going to happen. And try to explain to the waitress, who, you know, they understand, they're just not allowed to acknowledge that they understand that they're being replaced by this. For me, I just go, what? And I'm hoping that we see a boom. I'm hoping that we see a boom of organizing over the next 6 months, the next year, the next two, the next five. I'm hoping we see the explosion that we saw after the passage of the National Labor Relations Act. But it's going to take some help. It's going to take some help from Congress, but it's also going to take help from you and me. You know, the right wing has done a masterful job of demonizing workers organizing. They have done a masterful job of demonizing the organizations. They've done a masterful job of trying to divorce the members from their organization, much like they've done to the citizens and their country. I mean, every time you turn around, they're bashing our government. Oh, it's the government. No, it's our government. And are there problems? Absolutely, there always are. But we fix those and we move along. Same thing with workers and their unions. There are problems, but they fix them. You know, one of the last truly democratic organizations in this country. People vote for their representatives. Wow, there's a concept. And they vote for these representatives to represent them at a place where they spend a third of their lives. And it builds that kind of solidarity like we talked about it in the first hour, where 250 of your let me ask you, think about this for a second. Walmart worker, Target worker, Giant worker, big box retail worker, fast food worker. Think about this. Let's say you got fired tomorrow. I mean, really, stop and think about this, because it could happen. And if you don't have a collective bargaining agreement, your firing would be without recourse. I know, there are a bunch of people, all right, get a lawyer and sue. Good luck on that. Let me know how it works out for you. But get this for me, because I think it's important. Imagine you get fired tomorrow and you lose your job tomorrow. Do you think one of your coworkers right now is going to walk out and stand on the street corner and highlight the fact that you were wrongfully fired? Think of the community. Think of the brotherhood. Think of the solidarity in that. That scares corporate America to death. UPS has to do what they're doing because they cannot allow workers to have that kind of solidarity because you can't beat that. If we have a nation like that again, like my grandparents' generation, if we have that kind of looking after your neighbor, looking after your coworker, even if you don't like him. I mean, my grandfather hated some of the people he worked with. Hated them. But he would go out on strike with them. He would stand next to them. He would stand with them in those moments. So let me ask you, you get fired tomorrow, who cares? Honestly, you got to ask that question. Who stands up for you? And if your answer is no one, I think you better start asking some serious questions. Anyway, got to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Good evening. The world has never been spoken to quite this way. We've never been warned like this before, all of us, about climate change.
Blunt UN climate report warns the window of opportunity to act on climate change is closing.
Major funding for NOVA is provided by the David H. Koch Fund for Science.
The billionaire Koch brothers are environmental freedom fighters. Say, the Koch brothers. Texas breaks wind. Wind records, that is. Plus,
a much more optimistic study put out by my favorite environmental group, ExxonMobil.
ExxonMobil agrees the risk of climate change is clear, but says, F*** you, world, we're ExxonMobil.
All of those F*** yous and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
The global warming whiners at the UN have just released a report that I predict will raise the urine levels in your pants.
We'll see. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know we got a lot to get to today,
yep.
But before we do, I just want to give a shout-out and a welcome to our newest affiliate partners, The Rick Smith Show. We're happy to have them on board. You can check them out at TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks, Rick. Glad to have the Green News Report on your airwaves.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
What do you have for us today?
Well, on Monday, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report detailing the impacts of climate change, not just in coming decades, but impacts that are already hitting across all sectors of human society right now, from water to energy to our food supply, from agriculture and the oceans.
We see impacts from the equators to the poles and from the coast to the mountains. There's no question that we live in a world that's already altered by climate change.
That was the lead author of the new report, Dr. Chris Field. Now, the head of the IPCC, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, warns that unless we swiftly ramp down our greenhouse gas emissions, we risk pushing the climate beyond our ability to adapt as a species.
Nobody on this planet is going to be untouched by the impacts of climate change. If the world doesn't do anything about mitigating the emissions of greenhouse gases, then the very social stability of human systems could be at stake.
Oh, that's all.
Yeah, that's all. However, the IPCC report does offer some hope. While some serious impacts are already baked in and unavoidable, the window of opportunity has not yet closed to cut our emissions. And this is about risk management. We can still take the exit ramp by cutting fossil fuel emissions, and we can avoid the worst impacts.
Kudos to Brian Williams and the NBC Nightly News for giving this report, frankly, the coverage that it deserved right at the top of the network newscast. Contrast that, frankly, to the rest of cable news, and we got almost nothing on this startling new report.
Now, I did see good coverage on MSNBC, but CNN pretty much ignored it almost entirely.
And Fox News?
Nothing.
Nothing. Well, certainly they ridiculed it, yeah.
But here's the kicker. ExxonMobil is banking that we will fail on the same day as the IPCC's sobering climate impact report. ExxonMobil released a report to shareholders acknowledging, quote, the need to adopt policies to address climate change, but concluding that, quote, governments are highly unlikely to adopt policies that cut emissions. And, of course, Exxon will continue to use its oil profits to hire lobbyists who will influence politicians to ensure there's no climate legislation. In other words, Exxon says, yeah, we're going to overheat the planet, and you can't stop us.
As Stephen Colbert described this phenomenon of ExxonMobil taking its profits from dirty energy and taking this green cash to give to Congress to allow them to emit even more pollution.
It's a phenomenon called the greenhouse effects. Also, the green Senate effects.
Yeah, there you go.
Meanwhile, it sounds like an April Fool's Day prank, but it's not. Charles Koch of the infamous billionaire Koch brothers published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week asserting that he and his billionaire brother and their many polluting companies are excellent stewards of the environment, and he's spending his fossil fuel millions to deny climate change because he's really fighting for freedom.
Yes, we know he cares about science because if you watch Nova on PBS, it says Nova is sponsored by the David Koch Science Foundation, described this way.
The David H. Koch Fund for Science, supporting Nova and promoting public understanding of science.
Ah, yes. When I think of the Koch brothers, I think of supporting public understanding of science.
Finally, on March 27th of this year, the state of Texas generated nearly one-third of its electricity from harnessing the wind. 100% clean energy, and the fuel is free.
In the state of Texas?
Yep. They're the leader in wind energy.
The people who are busy voting for politicians who are against wind energy and solar energy. Oh, don't get me started. For much more on that, check our website instead at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to the Green News Report, at least until the David Koch Foundation for Science starts kicking in. Find us and follow us on the Facebook or the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Deep in the heart of Texas, the cowboys cry hi. Deep in the heart of Texas.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Yes, sirree, Friday it is. It is our future Friday, and we've got our good friend Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future to talk about what our future looks like. Isaiah, thanks for taking time for us.
Very much appreciate it.
Future not looking so bright after the Supreme Court decision on Wednesday. I got to be honest. Did I lose you?
No, you said you have to be honest, and I was waiting for you to be honest.
The future not looking all that bright with that decision. I got to be honest with you.
I know, and you know this is I think when you look at the public opinion polls, and which we've begun to do on a new site that we launched called populistmajority.org. You know, what you find consistently is a real disgust, actually, with how money has influenced politics. People do not like the idea that a small group of very wealthy people can buy the democracy and shut down the voices of ordinary people. The fact that the Supreme Court basically opened the doors for that to happen, it really is disgusting. And I have...
The question then is, I get it, and we're all there. We're all disgusted with the money in politics. We're disgusted with the cesspool that has become. What are we going to do about it? What I've seen people do, and sadly, what I foresee happening is people are just going to throw their hands up, go, they're all crooks, there's nothing we can do, and it will continue and get worse. Instead of people going, you know, I've got a viscerally negative reaction to anything the wealth class throws at me, and a massive backlash should ensue. I'm not seeing that.
Well, what's the danger is what you've already begun to see happening, which is this: the Democratic Party then getting into an arms race with the Republican Party. Right. Over trying to get the dollars of the money class. And I agree with you. Nothing will disenfranchise voters than starting that arms race. What I think some bold Democratic candidates have to do is to simply say, look, we're not in that game. We've got to, for the sake of the democracy, we've got to do this differently. And I think some people need to take some risks, speak out against this, say that they're not going to engage in this game of playing footsie with Wall Street to get their dollars so they can, you know, do this. And I think and part of what you have to do in order to make that work is to have some strong pro-people populist policies that you are going to hammer over and over and over again. And you get onto the sidewalks, and you do the old-style retail campaigning with the door knocking,
yep,
and the rallies and all of that. And I think that is just about the only way you get this thing, you break the back of this.
Basically, what I've been saying for the 9 years I've been on the air, you've got to get out in the streets. We've got to be talking to our neighbors. We've got to be knocking on doors. We've got to be everywhere all at once, as my grandparents' generation did. They took to the streets. If you read about the Great Depression, this country was being ripped apart by people who were saying, we're not putting up with it anymore. We want jobs. We want opportunity. We want a chance to feed our kids. And sadly, we're reliving a lot of what the 30s brought us.
We are living, after reliving a lot of what the 20s brought us, which was this extreme wealth inequality, and which resulted in massive Wall Street bubbles, which burst to disastrous effect. And, of course, today we saw an unemployment report on Friday that was released Friday morning, which said that the economy produced 194,000 jobs, which is way under what we really need to really soak up all of the long-term unemployment that we have out there.
No, I mean, I've asked the question, you know, demographically speaking, what's the number just to stay even? And I think it's somewhere in the 180 range. That just keeps us staying even with population growth, not even adding new jobs. And as I understand, we're back to where we were with the number of jobs that we had before the Bush collapse.
We are just now gotten to that point. Here it is, 2014. The official end of the recession was 2009. And so it's taken us this long just to fill in the hole that was created by the recession. But not all of the hole, because, as you pointed out, we've had population growth in that period. We really, in order to keep pace with where we would have been had there not been a recession, we would need to be creating jobs at a level of close to 400,000 jobs a month,
right,
not the 200,000 that we're averaging now.
And that would take some, investment by, because I truly believe the only way you kickstart things is you put demand into the economy. Tax cuts, not cutting it. We've learned this lesson that handing out more money to rich people isn't doing it. So I say we take that money back and we get stuff that we need. Like, I would like to be out of the third world with bad broadband internet access. I really would. I mean, this whole idea that I'm still, it's almost like dial-up where I live. That would be a good investment.
There's an article in the New York Times this weekend about the fact that Highway Trust Fund is on path to go bankrupt by the end of the year because our gasoline tax hasn't been increased since the mid-1990s. Imagine what would happen if we came up with a series of proposals, which would in part include asking those of us who drive, you know, to keep up a little bit with inflation. I mean, all of our other costs rise with inflation. Why not the gasoline tax? You know, we pay $4 a gallon when guys in the middle of the East decide to yank our chain. So why would we want to pay a few pennies more that for jobs in this country to improve the roads in this country and the mass transit in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I'm of the mindset that maybe we should be looking at what the real costs to society are with our current transportation system and then weigh it against maybe a public transportation system that could get me around and not in a way that I have to drive my car and not in a way I got to pay tolls and parking and maybe have a real adult conversation about how people get to and from places that they need to get to and from.
And that is why the McCutcheon, but you see, again, circling back to the whole money thing, the monopolization of the political debate that we're threatened to be under by the likes of the Koch brothers. Have you read that piece in the Wall Street Journal?
I did.
That Charles Koch.
I don't like being called un-American.
Yeah, I mean, and then labeling people collectivists and so forth. I mean, this is not the way to have an intelligent debate. I think those of us who are progressives are very interested in having, you know, real conversations about how do we make sure that America stays on top in terms of innovation and wealth creation and, you know, being in the forefront of the new markets of the future, the new businesses of the future, while at the same time making sure that our workers are well paid, that our Main Street economies are healthy. I mean, that's a wonderful conversation to have. And there are all kinds of ways we can have that conversation, but we cannot have that conversation when one of the people coming into that conversation has 400-watt speakers and a loud microphone, loud golden microphone, and, you know, 2-ton amplifiers to drown out everybody else. Can't happen.
Yeah. No, and at the end of it, this demonization of the word collectivist. I believe in the whole idea of collective action. That's how societies are built. You never see them complaining about our collectivist military. You never see much complaint about that, especially when the Koch brothers and their ilk profit so mightily off of it.
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that one of the people that Koch quoted was Thomas Jefferson. And actually, if you look, we have a really good article on our website about Thomas Jefferson and some of the quotes that Koch listed from Thomas Jefferson's writing. Jefferson was as much of a was a real collectivist, and more importantly, he was one of the founding fathers who was most critical about allowing wealth to have too much power in our politics.
Yep.
And so the true spirit of Jefferson, I think, is really a progressive spirit that says that, you know, you get to it's one person, one vote, not $1, one vote. And when you have a society which is too dominated by a small handful of wealthy individuals who have the power to buy democracy, that is a society that is in peril and is not in step with what the founding fathers envisioned for what we ought to have in a 21st century society.
I'm with you. And, you know, the sad reality is not just the accumulation of money into the hands of the few who have control of so much of the message. They also control the big corporations. You know, I keep citing the statistic I read not too long ago that 80% of everything that we see, hear, and read are owned by six corporations, multinational corporations, with not necessarily U.S. interests, and especially not U.S. workers' interests in mind, but 80% owned by just a handful of people. That's scary stuff.
That's very scary stuff. That's why I was very relieved. You know, there was a point at which there was a fear that the Kochs would get their hands on one of the major West Coast newspapers, I believe. And that fear was averted. But imagine, I mean, we always see what has happened with Murdoch and his control over Fox News, the Wall Street Journal, which the Charles Koch piece appeared in, and the New York Post.
I don't mind Murdoch owning the Post and Fox News. I see the New York Post and Fox News as identical. They're right there. They're on the same plane, in my view. But when they own the Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, and maybe I'm the only one who remembers that used to be their tagline. I haven't seen it in a while, but you know, when he owns the newspaper of the investor class, and he is now parroting the investor class's message, that begins to worry me.
Well, what really worries me is when these news organs are used then as political cudgels, as Fox News is, and at which point it shouldn't be called a news channel. I mean, it should be just bluntly called political channel. And maybe it wouldn't be, even that might not be so bad if it wasn't for the fact that what is often cited as the alternative, which is MSNBC, is actually owned by Comcast, which is the parent company of NBC Universal.
Yeah.
Comcast is not a liberal progressive organization. It is just a money-making outfit. And when it decides that it can't make money off of being host of Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes, it will do something else. And so that means that those of us who want an alternative to the Fox News political, conservative political bludgeon won't have that alternative.
I run into this all the time, Isaiah. I mean, you know, our funding here at this program, very meager. We're always weeks or a month away from going, well, that's the end of it, because you know, we can't sell to the big advertisers because I don't spew their message. And the sad reality in this country is there are very few places for programs like ours to go because we don't toe the corporate line. We don't toe the Koch brother line. And it's a huge struggle.
So this is why Scalia was so wrong. Because what he said was, you know, the same thing he said in the Citizens United ruling, which is that money is speech. And, you know, we all have a right to free speech, and therefore we all ought to have the right to spend whatever dollars we want to spend in order to acquire that speech. Well, then there's actually, when you start in the context of a democracy and in the context of elections, that gets to be a really big problem because, you know, it means that basically if money is speech and if your wealth is concentrated in the hands of a handful of like-minded people, then what happens? You have a handful of people with a whole lot of money who want to pull the country in one direction with the ability and the tools to shut down everybody else.
Well, what I've been saying is if money's speech, so are guns. I mean, if we're going to take it to that extreme, if you're going to take something like money, okay, fine. Money can buy you, but guns are a lot more effective. there you go. Gotcha on that one.
You got me on that one.
But, I mean, that's how ludicrous it is. I mean, that's how obscene this whole thing is. So let me ask you, last question I've got for you. What do we do then? I mean, do we get on the move to amend train? Like here in Pennsylvania, State Senator Leach has proposed publicly funded elections. Where do we go?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the model. I mean, I think there are lots of things that we can do on state level around the country. There have been, a few states that have done clean election laws. There are a few initiatives that have been going on the ballot. And in fact, I think the initiative process is a good way to begin to build this. If we get some sound clean election initiatives on the ballot at the state level, that will help inspire people who are sort of fed up about this money and politics thing to get out and push for something that will begin to solve it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that is piecemeal. It takes a while. There will be a couple of setbacks, but at least it's a start.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would do is Congress is going to be, the House is going to be voting on some budget resolutions this week. And one of those resolutions is the Better Off Budget, which we've talked about before. The Better Off Budget, which is put together by the Progressive Caucus, is an alternative to the Paul Ryan austerity budget, which would basically impoverish the poor and enrich the rich. What we need to do is, regardless of what the number one, Democrats should be supporting that Better Off Budget,
right.
Number one. But number two, once that budget vote is over, we know that that vote may go down against us, but we still need to talk about it. We still need to talk about what's in it.
Yeah.
We need to talk about the priority and make those priorities campaign issues.
And we need to push the agenda, just like the right does masterfully on their side. And we need, again, out into the streets. Very simple. Isaiah, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us, brother.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Isaiah Poole, Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org, the website. Lots of great stuff over there. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Reason and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Like that little choo-choo in the children's book, Moral Monday is the little movement that says, I think I can, and it just keeps chugging up the hill. This Progressive Citizens Action Coalition in North Carolina became a full-throttle citizens uprising in the Tar Heel State early last year. Fueled by rising public outrage at the rampant right-wing extremism of the Republican-run state government, a few advocates for workers' civil rights and other people's issues went inside the state capitol on a Monday in April. Led by Reverend William Barber, head of the state NAACP, they literally put their bodies on the line in protest of the GOP's reckless crusade to turn North Carolina into a privatized utopia for unfettered corporate greed and Tea Party wackiness. Several of the small group were arrested that day, and Republican leaders berated their protest as Moron Monday. But the politicos aren't laughing now. The protesters kept coming, and their numbers kept growing. For Moral Monday had struck a chord, and the protests spread across the state. A rally in February drew more than 80,000 people, and public approval ratings for the governor and state assembly have tanked. The legislature is now out of session, but Moral Monday still has weekly meetings and is launching a 50-county organizing and voter education campaign this summer. It's no longer a protest, but a burgeoning, multi-issue, grassroots movement for progressive change. And it's literally on the move, branching out to other states. Moral Monday, Georgia, is going full steam this year. South Carolina has a Truthful Tuesday movement gaining steam. And the movement is getting started in Alabama, Florida, New York, and Wisconsin. This is Jim Hightower saying, some of these states are mighty steep political hills for progressives to climb, but success begins with someone saying, I think I can. I think I can. To have a movement, you've got to start moving.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
It's not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Why do you can't turn off the sounds of the truth? Lock off the jazz, got the Rick
can't do that. Can't kill the protester. You know, I've been saying this for a while. They're going to kill him. You go back to the history of labor, and this is one of those things our education system has failed to teach our children. I often call it the bullets, the billy clubs, the briefcases story. First, you know, they just you'd have miners walking from Allentown to Scranton, and they'd be met in Latimer, Pennsylvania, by deputies who were handed, here, got the anointment, you're a deputy, here's a gun. And as the workers would come walking up peaceably, without any arms, they'd be shot in the back. And then people got upset about that. Oh, Canada, you're shooting people in the back. Demand government to do something. Well, we stopped shooting them. And then whenever they would get out of hand, they would hire a bunch of people to go with clubs and beat them. Well, then that became less palatable. Now we just pay really high-priced attorneys with really nice leather briefcases to go in and do the same dirty work. And dirty work that it is. You know, so I look at all of these situations, and you got with open eyes and an open mind, look at the situation that this country is in. Look at the working conditions that we're in. And look, I'm not somebody who's going to say that all businesses are bad, but you know what? It seems like a lot of them. And the good ones, to be honest, they would be the ones willing to sit down and negotiate and talk to you. Just seems reasonable to me. Anyway, next week during the program, we're going to be in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO's biannual convention. They do it every 2 years, and they switch between Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. This year, it's going to be in Pittsburgh. We're going to be there in the Wyndham Grand Hotel in Pittsburgh, where the convention will be interviewing folks who are attending. We're going to talk to workers. We're going to talk about issues. We're going to look at the future and say, you know, we'll explain how we get to this place. What's the vision for the country? I think it's going to be a good opportunity to examine some of the things important to working people and, you know, maybe ask questions and go through the whole thing. We will be doing live-to-tape programming. Our capability here to do it live, I'm still a little leery of. Because when we've done remotes in the past, it's spotty at best. So we're going to tape, and then we'll play it here on the program. If you have any thoughts, any questions, any comments, by all means, please reach out to me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. And we'll be asking for that the whole time we're in Pittsburgh. But I just think this is an excellent opportunity to get out and to meet people and get folks that we normally wouldn't have a chance to talk much to. Talk about issues important to their members and to workers across this Commonwealth. So I'm excited about it. It's always fun to do these on location things. Also to be able to to get face to face. You know, here on the program we do a lot of phone interviews. I'm looking forward to sitting down face to face with folks and having those conversations. Also, again, I'd love your input. Rick@therickssmithshow.com. Facebook.com/RickSmithShow or on the Twitters @RickSmithShow. One last thing before we go. On my Facebook page, I've got a thing up that says, hey, I could use some money for muscular dystrophy. I'm doing the lockup thing. So if you could help out, that would be great. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial mysterious.